relief. Whoever this was, it was not the black-cloaked rider. Then he saw the curled ram's horns on the head that brushed the top of the doorway, and where the mouth and nose should have been was a hairy muzzle. He took in all of it in the space of one deep breath that he let out in a terrified yell, as, without thinking, he hurled the hot kettle at the half-human head. The creature roared, part scream of pain, part animal snarl, as boiling water splashed over its face. Even as the kettle struck, Tam's sword flashed. The roar abruptly became a gurgle, and the huge shape toppled back. Before it finished falling, another was trying to claw its way past. Rand glimpsed a misshapen head topped by spike-like horns before Tam struck again, and two huge bodies blocked the door. He realized his father was shouting at him.
"Run, lad! Hide in the woods!"
The bodies in the doorway jerked as others outside tried to pull them clear. Tam thrust a shoulder under the massive table. With a grunt, he heaved it over atop the tangle.
"There are too many to hold. Out the back. Go, go, I'll follow."
Even as Rand turned away, shame filled him that he obeyed so quickly. He wanted to stay and help his father, though he could not imagine how. But fear had him by the throat, and his legs moved on their own. He dashed from the room, toward the back of the house, as fast as he had ever run in his life. Crashes and shouts from the front door pursued him. He had his hands on the bar across the back door when his eye fell on the iron lock that was never locked. Except that Tam had done just that tonight. Letting the bar stay where it was, he darted to a side window, flung up the sash, and threw back the shutters. Night had replaced twilight completely. The full moon and drifting clouds made dappled shadows chase one another across the farmyard. Shadows, he told himself. Only shadows. The back door creaked as someone outside, or something, tried to push it open. His mouth went dry. A crash shook the door in its frame and lent him speed. He slipped through the window like a hare going to ground and cowered against the side of the house. Inside the room, wood splintered like thunder. He forced himself up to a crouch, made himself peer inside, just with one eye, just at the corner of the window. In the dark, he could not make out much, but more than he really wanted to see. The door hung askew, and shadowed shapes moved cautiously into the room, talking in low, guttural voices. Rand understood none of what was said. The language sounded harsh, unsuited to a human tongue. Axes and spears and spike things dully reflected stray glimmers of moonlight. Boots scraped on the floor, and there was a rhythmic click, as of hooves as well. He tried to work moisture back into his mouth. Drawing a deep, ragged breath, he shouted as loudly as he could, "They're coming in the back!" The words came out in a croak, but at least they came out. He had not been sure they would.
"I'm outside! Run, father!"
With the last word, he was sprinting away from the farmhouse. Coarse-voiced shouts in the strange tongue raged from the back room. Glass shattered, loud and sharp, and something thudded heavily to the ground behind him. He guessed one of them had broken through the window rather than try to squeeze through the opening. But he did not look back to see if he was right. Like a fox running from hounds, he darted into the nearest mooncast shadows, as if headed for the woods, then dropped to his belly and slithered back to the barn and its larger, deeper shadows. Something fell across his shoulders, and he thrashed about, not sure if he was trying to fight or escape, until he realized he was grappling with the new hoe handle Tam had been shaping.
Idiot.
For a moment he lay there, trying to stop panting.
Coupling fool, idiot.
At last he crawled on along the back of the barn, dragging the hoe handle with him. It was not much, but it was better than nothing. Cautiously, he looked around the corner at the farmyard and the house. Of the creature that had jumped out after him, there was no sign. It could be anywhere. Hunting him, surely. Even creeping up on him at that very moment. Frightened bleats filled the sheep pen to his left. The flock milled as if trying to find an escape. Shattered shapes flickered in the lighted front windows of the house, and the clash of steel on steel rang through the darkness. Suddenly one of the windows burst outward in a shower of glass and wood, as Tam leaped through it, sword still in hand. He landed on his feet, but instead of running away from the house, he dashed toward the back of it, ignoring the monstrous things scrambling after him through the broken window in the doorway. Rand stared in disbelief. Why was he not trying to get away? Then he understood. Tam had last heard his voice from the rear of the house.
"Father!" he shouted. "I'm over here!"
In mid-stride, Tam whirled, not running toward Rand, but at an angle away from him.
"Run, Rand!"
he shouted, gesturing with the sword as if to someone ahead of him.
"Hide!"
A dozen huge forms streamed after him, harsh shouts and shrill howls shivering the air. Rand pulled back into the shadows behind the barn. There he could not be seen from the house, in case any of the creatures were still inside. He was safe, for the moment at least. But not Tam. Tam, who was trying to lead those things away from him. His hands tightened on the hoe handle, and he had to clench his teeth to stop a sudden laugh. A hoe handle. Facing one of those creatures with a hoe handle would not be much like playing at quarterstaffs with Perrin. But he could not let Tam face what was chasing him alone.
"If I move like I was stalking a rabbit," he whispered to himself, "they'll never hear me or see me."
The eerie cries echoed in the darkness, and he tried to swallow.
More like a pack of starving wolves.
Soundlessly, he slipped away from the barn toward the forest, gripping the hoe handle so hard that his hands hurt. At first, when the trees surrounded him, he took comfort from them. They helped hide him from whatever the creatures were that had attacked the farm. As he crept through the woods, though, moon shadows shifted, and it began to seem as if the darkness of the forest changed and moved, too. Trees loomed malevolently, branches writhed toward him. But were they just trees and branches? He could almost hear the growling chuckles stifled in their throats while they waited for him. The howls of Tam's pursuers no longer filled the night, but in the silence that replaced them, he flinched every time the wind scraped one limb against another. Lower and lower he crouched, and moved more and more slowly. He hardly dared to breathe for fear he might be heard. Suddenly a hand closed over his mouth from behind, and an iron grip seized his wrist. Frantically he clawed over his shoulder with his free hand for some hold on the attacker.
"Don't break my neck, lad," came Tam's hoarse whisper.
Relief flooded him, turning his muscles to water. When his father released him, he fell to his hands and knees, gasping as if he had run for miles. Tam dropped down beside him, leaning on one elbow.
"I wouldn't have tried that if I had thought how much you've grown in the last few years," Tam said softly.
His eyes shifted constantly as he spoke, keeping a sharp watch in the darkness.
"But I had to make sure you didn't speak out. Some Trollocs can hear like a dog. Maybe better."
"But Trollocs are just..."
Rand let the words trail off. "Not just a story. Not after tonight." Those things could be Trollocs or the Dark One himself, for all he knew.
"Are you sure?" he whispered. "I mean, Trollocs?"
"I'm sure. Though what brought them to the Two Rivers? I never saw one before tonight, but I've talked with men who have, so I know a little. Maybe enough to keep us alive. Listen closely. A Trolloc can see better than a man in the dark, but bright lights blind them, for a time at least. That may be the only reason we got away from so many. Some can track by scent or sound, but they're said to be lazy. If we can keep out of their hands long enough, they should give up."
That made Rand feel only a little better.
"In the stories, they hate men and serve the Dark One."
"If anything belongs in the Shepherd of the Night's flocks, lad, it is Trollocs. They kill for the pleasure of killing, so I've been told. But that's the end of my knowledge, except that they cannot be trusted unless they're afraid of you, and then not far."
Rand shivered. He did not think he would want to meet anyone a Trolloc was afraid of.
"Do you think they're still hunting for us?"
"Maybe, maybe not. They don't seem very smart.
Once we got into the forest, I sent the ones after me off toward the mountains without much trouble." Tam fumbled at his right side, then put his hand close to his face.
"Best act as if they are, though."
"You're hurt."
"Keep your voice down. It's just a scratch. And there is nothing to be done about it now, anyway. At least the weather seems to be warming."
He lay back with a heavy sigh.
"Perhaps it won't be too bad spending the night out."
In the back of his mind, Rand had just been thinking fond thoughts of his coat and cloak. The trees cut the worst of the wind, but what gusted through still sliced like a frozen knife. Hesitantly, he touched Tam's face and winced.
"You're on fire." "I have to get you to Nynaeve."
"In a bit, lad."
"We don't have any time to waste. It's a long way in the dark."
He scrambled to his feet and tried to pull his father up. A groan, barely stifled by Tam's clenched teeth, made Rand hastily ease him back down.
"Let me rest a while, boy. I'm tired.
Rand pounded his fist on his thigh. Snug in the farmhouse, with a fire and blankets, plenty of water and willow bark, he might have been willing to wait for daybreak before hitching Bella and taking Tam into the village. Here was no fire, no blankets, no cart, and no Bella. But those things were still back at the house. If he could not carry Tam to them, perhaps he could bring some of them, at least, to Tam. If the Trollocs were gone, they had to go sooner or later. He looked at the hoe handle, then dropped it. Instead, he drew Tam's sword. The blade gleamed dully in the pale moonlight. The long hilt felt odd in his hand. The weight and heft were strange. He slashed at the air a few times before stopping with a sigh. Slashing at air was easy. If he had to do it against a Trolloc, he was surely just as likely to run instead, or freeze stiff, so he could not move at all until a Trolloc swung one of those odd swords and... Stop it. It's not helping anything. As he started to rise, Tam caught his arm.
Where are you going?
We need the cart, he said gently, and blankets. He was shocked at how easily he pulled his father's hand from his sleeve.
Rest, and I'll be back. Careful, Tam breathed.
He could not see Tam's face in the moonlight, but he could feel his eyes on him.
I will be.
As careful as a mouse exploring a hawk's nest, he thought. As silently as another shadow, he slid into the darkness. He thought of all the times he had played tag in the woods with his friends as children, stalking one another, straining not to be heard until he put a hand on someone's shoulder. Somehow he could not make this seem the same. Creeping from tree to tree, he tried to make a plan, but by the time he reached the edge of the woods, he had made and discarded 10. Everything depended on whether or not the Trollocs were still there. If they were gone, he could simply walk up to the house and take what he needed. If they were still there... In that case, there was nothing for it but go back to Tam. He did not like it, but he could do Tam no good by getting killed. He peered toward the farm buildings. The barn and the sheep pen were only dark shapes in the moonlight. Light spilled from the front windows of the house, though, and through the open front door. Just the candles father lit, or are there Trollocs waiting? He jumped convulsively at a nighthawk's reedy cry, then sagged against a tree, shaking. This was getting him nowhere. Dropping to his belly, he began to crawl, holding the sword awkwardly before him. He kept his chin in the dirt all the way to the back of the sheep pen. Crouched against the stone wall, he listened. Not a sound disturbed the night. Carefully, he eased up enough to look over the wall. Nothing moved in the farmyard. No shadows flickered against the lit windows of the house or in the doorway. Bella and the cart first, or the blankets and other things. It was the light that decided him. The barn was dark. Anything could be waiting inside, and he would have no way of knowing until it was too late. At least he would be able to see what was inside the house. As he started to lower himself again, he stopped suddenly. There was no sound. Most of the sheep might have settled down already and gone back to sleep, though it was not likely. But a few were always awake, even in the middle of the night, rustling about, bleating now and again. He could barely make out the shadowy mounds of sheep on the ground. One lay almost beneath him. Trying to make no noise, he hoisted himself onto the wall until he could stretch out a hand to the dim shape. His fingers touched curly wool, then wetness. The sheep did not move. Breath left him in a rush as he pushed back, almost dropping the sword as he fell to the ground outside the pen. They kill for fun. Shakily, he scrubbed the wetness from his hand in the dirt. Fiercely, he told himself that nothing had changed. The Trollocs had done their butchery and gone. Repeating that in his mind, he crawled on across the farmyard, keeping as low as he could, but trying to watch every direction, too. He had never thought he would envy an earthworm. At the front of the house, he lay close beside the wall, beneath the broken window, and listened. The dull thudding of blood in his ears was the loudest sound he heard. Slowly he reared up and peered inside. The stew pot lay upside down in the ashes on the hearth. Splintered, broken wood littered the room. Not a single piece of furniture remained whole. Even the table rested at an angle, two legs hacked to rough stubs. Every drawer had been pulled out and smashed. Every cupboard and cabinet stood open, many doors hanging by one hinge. Their contents were strewn over the wreckage, and everything was dusted with white. Flour and salt, to judge from the slashed sacks tossed down by the fireplace. Four twisted bodies made a tangle in the remnants of the furnishings. Trollocs. Rand recognized one by its ram's horns. The others were much the same, even in their differences. A repulsive melange of human faces distorted by muzzles, horns, feathers, and fur. Their hands, almost human, only made it worse. Two wore boots, the others had hooves. He watched without blinking until his eyes burned. None of the Trollocs moved. They had to be dead. And Tam was waiting. He ran in through the front door and stopped, gagging at the stench. A stable that had not been mucked out in months was the only thing he could think of that might come close to matching it. Vile smears defiled the walls. Trying to breathe through his mouth, he hurriedly began poking through the mess on the floor. There had been a water bag in one of the cupboards. A scraping sound behind him sent a chill to his marrow, and he spun, almost falling over the remains of the table. He caught himself and moaned behind teeth that would have chattered had he not had them clenched until his jaw ached. One of the Trollocs was getting to its feet. A wolf's muzzle jutted out between sunken eyes. Flat, emotionless eyes, and all too human. Hairy, pointed ears twitched incessantly. It stepped over one of its dead companions on sharp goat hooves. The same black mail the others wore rasped against leather trousers, and one of the huge, scythe-curved swords swung at its side. It muttered something, guttural and sharp, then said,
"Others go away. Narg stay. Narg smart."
The words were distorted and hard to understand, coming from a mouth never meant for human speech. Its tone was meant to be soothing, he thought, but he could not take his eyes off the stained teeth, long and sharp, that flashed every time the creature spoke.
"Narg know some comeback sometime. Narg wait. You no need sword. Put sword down."
Until the Trolloc spoke, Rand did not realize that he held Tam's sword wavering before him in both hands, its point aimed at the huge creature. It towered head and shoulders above him with the chest and arms to dwarf Master Luhan.
"Narg no hurt."
It took a step closer, gesturing.
"You put sword down."
The dark hair in the backs of its hands was thick like fur.
"Stay back," Rand said, wishing his voice was steadier. "Why did you do this? Why?"
"Velja de Garugda."
The snarl quickly became a toothy smile.
"Put sword down. Narg no hurt. Murdral want talk you."
A flash of emotion crossed the distorted face. Fear.
"Others come back. You talk, Murdral."
It took another step, one big hand coming to rest on its own sword hilt.
"You put sword down."
Rand wet his lips.
"Murdral."
The worst of the stories was walking tonight. If a fade was coming, it made a Trolloc pale by comparison. He had to get away. But if the Trolloc drew that massive blade, he would not have a chance. He forced his lips into a shaky smile.
"All right."
Grip tightening on the sword, he let both hands drop to his sides.
"I'll talk."
The wolf smile became a snarl, and the Trolloc lunged for him. Rand had not thought anything that big could move so fast. Desperately, he brought his sword up. The monstrous body crashed into him, slamming him against the wall. Breath left his lungs in one gasp. He fought for air as they fell to the floor together, the Trolloc on top. Frantically, he struggled beneath the crushing weight, trying to avoid thick hands groping for him and snapping jaws. Abruptly, the Trolloc spasmed and was still. Battered and bruised, half-suffocated by the bulk on top of him, for a moment Rand could only lie there in disbelief. Quickly he came to his senses, though, enough to writhe out from under the body, at least. And body it was. The bloodied blade of Tam's sword stood out from the center of the Trolloc's back. He had gotten it up in time after all. Blood covered Rand's hands as well, and made a blackish smear across the front of his shirt. His stomach churned, and he swallowed hard to keep from being sick. He shook as hard as he had in the worst of his fear, but this time, in relief at still being alive. "Others come back," the Trolloc had said. The other Trollocs would be returning to the farmhouse. And a Murdral, a fade. The stories said fades were 20 feet tall, with eyes of fire, and they rode shadows like horses. When a fade turned sideways, it disappeared, and no wall could stop them. He had to do what he had come for and get away quickly. Grunting with the effort, he heaved the Trolloc's body over to get the sword, and almost ran when open eyes stared at him. It took him a minute to realize they were staring through the glaze of death. He wiped his hands on a tattered rag, it had been one of Tam's shirts only that morning, and tugged the blade free. Cleaning the sword, he reluctantly dropped the rag on the floor. There was no time for neatness, he thought, with a laugh that he had to clamp his teeth shut to stop. He did not see how they could ever clean the house well enough for it to be lived in again. The horrible stench had probably already soaked right into the timbers. But there was no time to think of that. No time for neatness, no time for anything, maybe. He was sure he was forgetting any number of things they would need, but Tam was waiting and the Trollocs were coming back. He gathered what he could think of on the run. Blankets from the bedrooms upstairs and clean clothes to bandage Tam's wound. Their cloaks and coats, a water bag that he carried when he took the sheep to pasture. A clean shirt. He did not know when he would have time to change, but he wanted to get out of his blood-smeared shirt at the first opportunity. The small bags of willow bark and their other medicines were part of a dark, muddy-looking pile he could not bring himself to touch. One bucket of the water Tam had brought in still stood by the fireplace, miraculously unspilled and untouched. He filled the water bag from it, gave his hands a hasty wash and the rest, and made one more quick search for anything he might have forgotten. He found his bow among the wreckage, broken cleanly in two at the thickest point. He shuddered as he let the pieces fall. What he had gathered already would have to do, he decided. Quickly, he piled everything outside the door. The last thing before leaving the house, he dug a shuttered lantern from the mess on the floor. It still held oil. Lighting it from one of the candles, he closed the shutters, partly against the wind, but mostly to keep from drawing attention, and hurried outside with the lantern in one hand and the sword in the other. He was not sure what he would find in the barn. The sheep pen kept him from hoping too much. But he needed the cart to get Tam to Emmons Field, and for the cart he needed Bella. Necessity made him hope a little. The barn doors stood open, one creaking on its hinges as it shifted in the wind. The interior looked as it always had, at first. Then his eyes fell on empty stalls, the stall doors ripped from their hinges. Bella and the cow were gone. Quickly he went to the back of the barn. The cart lay on its side, half the spokes broken out of its wheels. One shaft was only a foot-long stump. The despair he had been holding at bay filled him. He was not sure he could carry Tam as far as the village, even if his father could bear to be carried. The pain of it might kill Tam more quickly than the fever. Still, it was the only chance left. He had done all he could do here. As he turned to go, his eyes fell on the hacked-off cart shaft lying on the straw-strewn floor. Suddenly, he smiled. Hurriedly, he set the lantern and the sword on the straw-covered floor, and in the next instant, he was wrestling with the cart, tipping it back over to fall upright with a snap of more breaking spokes, then throwing his shoulder into it to heave it over on the other side. The undamaged shaft stood straight out. Snatching up the sword, he hacked at the well-seasoned ash. To his pleased surprise, great chips flew with his strokes, and he cut through as quickly as he could have with a good axe. When the shaft fell free, he looked at the sword blade in wonder. Even the best sharpened axe would have dulled chopping through that hard, aged wood, but the sword looked as brightly sharp as ever. He touched the edge with his thumb, then hastily stuck it in his mouth. The blade was still razor sharp. But he had no time for wonder. Blowing out the lantern, there was no need to have the barn burned down on top of everything else. He gathered up the shafts and ran back to get what he had left at the house. Altogether, it made an awkward burden. Not a heavy one, but hard to balance and manage. The cart shafts shifting and twisting in his arms as he stumbled across the plowed field. Once back in the forest, they were even worse, catching on trees and knocking him half off his feet. They would have been easier to drag, but that would leave a clear trail behind him. He intended to wait as long as possible before doing that. Tam was right where he had left him, seemingly asleep. He hoped it was sleep. Suddenly fearful, he dropped his burdens and put a hand to his father's face. Tam still breathed, but the fever was worse. The touch roused Tam, but only into a hazy wakefulness.
"Is that you, boy?" he breathed. "Worried about you. Dreams of days gone. Nightmares."
Murmuring softly, he drifted off again.
"Don't worry," Rand said.
He laid Tam's coat and cloak over him to keep off the wind.
"I'll get you to Nine Neve just as quickly as I can."
As he went on, as much to reassure himself as for Tam's benefit, he peeled off his blood-stained shirt, hardly even noticing the cold in his haste to be rid of it, and hurriedly pulled on the clean one. Throwing his old shirt away made him feel as if he had just had a bath.
"We'll be safe in the village in no time, and the wisdom will set everything right. You'll see. Everything's going to be all right."
That thought was like a beacon as he pulled on his coat and bent to tend Tam's wound. They would be safe once they reached the village, and Nynaeve would cure Tam. He just had to get him there. Chapter 6 The Westwood. In the moonlight, Rand could not really see what he was doing, but Tam's wound seemed to be only a shallow gash along the ribs, no longer than the palm of his hand. He shook his head in disbelief. He had seen his father take more of an injury than that, and not even stop work except to wash it off. Hastily he searched Tam from head to foot for something bad enough to account for the fever, but the one cut was all he could find. Small as it was, that lone cut was still grave enough. The flesh around it burned to the touch. It was even hotter than the rest of Tam's body, and the rest of him was hot enough to make Rand's jaws clench. A scalding fever like that could kill or leave a man a husk of what he had once been. He soaked a cloth with water from the skin and laid it across Tam's forehead. He tried to be gentle about washing and bandaging the gash on his father's ribs, but soft groans still interrupted Tam's low muttering. Stark branches loomed around them, threatening as they shifted in the wind. Surely the Trollocs would go on their way when they failed to find Tam and him, when they came back to the farmhouse and found it still empty. He tried to make himself believe it, but the wanton destruction at the house, the senselessness of it, left little room for belief of that sort. Believing they would give up short of killing everyone and everything they could find was dangerous, a foolish chance he could not afford to take.
Trollocs. Light above, Trollocs. Creatures out of the Gleeman's Tale coming out of the night to bash in the door. And a fade. Light shine on me, a fade.
Abruptly he realized he was holding the untied ends of the bandage in motionless hands.
Frozen like a rabbit that's seen a hawk's shadow, he thought scornfully.
With an angry shake of his head, he finished tying the bandage around Tam's chest. Knowing what he had to do, even getting on with it, did not stop him being afraid. When the Trollocs came back, they would surely begin searching the forest around the farm for some trace of the people who had escaped them. The body of the one he had killed would tell them those people were not far off. Who knew what a fade would do, or could do? On top of that, his father's comment about Trollocs' hearing was as loud in his mind as if Tam had just said it. He found himself resisting the urge to put a hand over Tam's mouth to still his groans and murmurs.
Some track by scent. What can I do about that? Nothing.
He could not waste time worrying over problems he could do nothing about.
You have to keep quiet, he whispered in his father's ear. The Trollocs will be back.
Tam spoke in hushed, hoarse tones.
You're still lovely, Kari. Still lovely as a girl.
Rand grimaced. His mother had been dead 15 years. If Tam believed she was still alive, then the fever was even worse than Rand had thought. How could he be kept from speaking, now that silence might mean life?
Mother wants you to be quiet, Rand whispered.
He paused to clear his throat of a sudden tightness. She had had gentle hands. He remembered that much.
Kari wants you to be quiet. Here, drink.
Tam gulped thirstily from the water skin, but after a few swallows, he turned his head aside and began murmuring softly again, too low for Rand to understand. He hoped it was too low to be heard by hunting Trollocs, too. Hastily, he got on with what was needed. Three of the blankets he wove around and between the shafts cut from the cart, contriving a makeshift litter. He would only be able to carry one end, letting the other drag on the ground, but it would have to do. From the last blanket, he cut a long strip with his belt knife, then tied one end of the strip to each of the shafts. As gently as he could, he lifted Tam onto the litter, wincing with every moan. His father had always seemed indestructible. Nothing could harm him, nothing could stop him, or even slow him down. For him to be in this condition almost robbed Rand of what courage he had managed to gather. But he had to keep on. That was all that kept him moving. He had to. When Tam finally lay on the litter, Rand hesitated, then took the sword belt from his father's waist. When he fastened it around himself, it felt odd there. It made him feel odd. Belt and sheath and sword together only weighed a few pounds, but when he sheathed the blade, it seemed to drag at him like a great weight. Angrily, he berated himself. This was no time or place for foolish fancies. It was only a big knife. How many times had he daydreamed about wearing a sword and having adventures? If he could kill one Trolloc with it, he could surely fight off any others as well. Only he knew all too well that what had happened in the farmhouse had been the purest luck. And his daydream adventures had never included his teeth chattering, or running for his life through the night, or his father at the point of death. Hastily he tucked the last blanket around Tam, and laid the waterskin and the rest of the cloths beside his father on the litter. With a deep breath he knelt between the shafts and lifted the strip of blanket over his head. It settled across his shoulders and under his arms. When he gripped the shafts and straightened, most of the weight was on his shoulders. It did not seem like very much. Trying to keep a smooth pace, he set out for Emmons Field, the litter scraping along behind him. He had already decided to make his way to the quarry road and follow that to the village. The danger would almost certainly be greater along the road, but Tam would receive no help at all if he got them lost, trying to find his way through the woods in the dark. In the darkness, he was almost out onto the quarry road before he knew it. When he realized where he was, his throat tightened like a fist. Hurriedly, he turned the litter around and dragged it back into the trees away, then stopped to catch his breath and let his heart stop pounding. Still panting, he turned east toward Emmons Field. Traveling through the trees was more difficult than taking Tam down the road, and the night surely did not help. But going out onto the road itself would be madness. The idea was to reach the village without meeting any Trollocs, without even seeing any if he had his wish. He had to assume the Trollocs were still hunting them, and sooner or later they would realize that two had set off for the village. That was the most likely place to go, and the quarry road the most likely route. In truth, he found himself closer to the road than he liked. The night and the shadows under the trees seemed awfully bare cover in which to hide from the eyes of anyone traveling along it. Moonlight filtering through bare branches gave only enough illumination to fool his eyes into thinking they saw what was underfoot. Roots threatened to trip him at every step. Old brambles snagged his legs, and sudden dips or rises in the ground had him half falling as his foot met nothing but air where he expected firm earth, or stumbling when his toe struck dirt while still moving forward. Tam's mutterings broke into a sharp groan whenever one of the shafts bumped too quickly over a root or rock. Uncertainty made him peer into the darkness until his eyes burned, listened as he had never listened before. Every scrape of branch against branch, every rustle of pine needles, brought him to a halt, ears straining, hardly daring to breathe for fear he might not hear some warning sound, for fear he might hear that sound. Only when he was sure it was just the wind would he go on. Slowly weariness crept into his arms and legs, driven home by a night wind that mocked his cloak and coat. The weight of the litter, so little at the start, now tried to pull him to the ground. His stumbles were no longer all from tripping. The almost constant struggle not to fall took as much out of him as did the actual work of pulling the litter. He had been up before dawn to begin his chores, and even with the trip to Emmons Field, he had done almost a full day's work. On any normal night, he would be resting before the fireplace, reading one of Tam's small collection of books before going to bed. The sharp chill soaked into his bones, and his stomach reminded him that he had had nothing to eat since Mr. Salvier's honey cakes. He muttered to himself, angry at not taking some food at the farm. A few minutes more could not have made any difference. A few minutes to find some bread and cheese. The Trollocs would not have come back in just a few minutes more. Or just the bread. Of course, Mr. Salvier would insist on putting a hot meal in front of him once they reached the inn. A steaming plate of her thick lamb stew, probably. And some of that bread she had been baking. And lots of hot tea.
"They came over the dragon wall like a flood," Tam said suddenly, in a strong, angry voice. "And washed the land with blood."
"How many died for lemons, sin?"
Rand almost fell from surprise. Wearily he lowered the litter to the ground and untangled himself. The strip of blanket left a burning groove in his shoulders. Struggling to work the knots out, he knelt beside Tam. Fumbling for the water bag, he peered through the trees, trying vainly in the dim moonlight to see up and down the road, not 20 paces away. Nothing moved there but shadows. Nothing but shadows.
"There isn't any flood of Trollocs, Father. Not now, anyway. We'll be safe in Emmons Field soon. Drink a little water."
Tam brushed aside the water bag with an arm that seemed to have regained all of its strength. He seized Rand's collar, pulling him close enough to feel the heat of his father's fever in his own cheek.
"They called them savages," Tam said urgently. "The fools said they could be swept aside like rubbish. How many battles lost, how many cities burned, before they faced the truth, before the nations stood together against them?"
He loosed his hold on Rand, and sadness filled his voice.
The field at Morroth, carpeted with the dead, and no sound but the cries of ravens and the buzzing of flies. The topless towers of Cairene, burning in the night like torches. All the way to the shining walls they burned and slew before they were turned back. All the way to...
Rand clamped a hand over his father's mouth. The sound came again, a rhythmic thudding, directionless in the trees, fading, then growing stronger again as the wind shifted. Frowning, he turned his head slowly, trying to decide from where it came. A flicker of motion caught the corner of his eye, and in an instant he was crouched over Tam. He was startled to feel the hilt of the sword clutched tight in his hand, but most of him concentrated on the quarry road, as if the road were the only real thing in the entire world. Wavering shadows to the east slowly resolved themselves into a horse and rider, followed up the road by tall, bulky shapes trotting to keep up with the animal. The pale light of the moon glittered from spearheads and axe blades. Rand never even considered that they might be villagers coming to help. He knew what they were. He could feel it, like grit scraping his bones, even before they drew close enough for moonlight to reveal the hooded cloak swathing the horsemen, a cloak that hung undisturbed by the wind. All of the shapes appeared black in the night, and the horse's hooves made the same sounds that any others would, but Rand knew this horse from any other. Behind the dark rider came nightmare forms with horns and muzzles and beaks. Trollocs in a double file, all in steps, boots and hooves striking the ground at the same instant as if obeying a single mind. Rand counted 20 as they ran past. He wondered what kind of man would dare turn his back on so many trollocs. Or on one, for that matter. The trotting column disappeared westward, thumping footfalls fading into the darkness. But Rand remained where he was, not moving a muscle except to breathe. Something told him to be certain, absolutely certain, they were gone before he moved. At long last he drew a deep breath and began to straighten. This time the horse made no sound at all. In eerie silence the dark rider returned, his shadowy mount stopping every few steps as it walked slowly back down the road. The wind gusted higher, moaning through the trees. The horseman's cloak lay still as death. Whenever the horse halted, that hooded head swung from side to side as the rider peered into the forest searching. Exactly opposite Rand, the horse stopped again, the shattered opening of the hood turning toward where he crouched above his father. Rand's hand tightened convulsively on the sword hilt. He felt the gaze, just as he had that morning, and shivered again from the hatred, even if he could not see it. That shrouded man hated everyone and everything. Everything that lived. Despite the cold wind, sweat beaded on Rand's face. Then the horse was moving on, a few soundless steps and stop, until all Rand could see was a barely distinguishable blur in the night far down the road. It could have been anything, but he had not taken his eyes off it for a second. If he lost it, he was afraid the next time he saw the black-cloaked rider might be when that silent horse was on top of him. Abruptly, the shadow was rushing back, passing him in a silent gallop. The rider looked only ahead of him as he sped westward into the night, toward the mountains of mist, toward the farm. Rand sagged, gulping air and scrubbing cold sweat off his face with his sleeve. He did not care anymore about why the Trollocs had come. If he never found out why, that would be fine, just as long as it was all ended. With a shake, he gathered himself, hastily checking his father. Tam was still murmuring, but so softly, Rand could not make out the words. He tried to give him a drink, but the water spilled over his father's chin. Tam coughed and choked on the trickle that made it into his mouth, then began muttering again, as if there had not been any interruption. Rand splashed a little more water on the cloth on Tam's forehead, pushed the water bag back on the litter, and scrambled between the shafts again. He started out as if he had had a good night's sleep, but the new strength did not last long. Fear masked his tiredness in the beginning, but though the fear remained, the mask melted away quickly. Soon he was back to stumbling forward, trying to ignore hunger and aching muscles. He concentrated on putting one foot in front of the other without tripping. In his mind, he pictured Emmons Field, shutters thrown back and the houses lit for winter night, people shouting greetings as they passed back and forth on their visits, fiddles filling the streets with James Folly and Heron on the Wing. Harald Luhan would have one too many brandies and start singing The Wind in the Barley in a voice like a bullfrog, He always did, until his wife managed to shush him, and Senbui would decide to prove he could still dance as well as ever, and Matt would have something planned that would not quite happen the way he intended, and everybody would know he was responsible, even if no one could prove it. He could almost smile thinking about how it would be. After a time, Tam spoke up again.
Avendasora. It said it makes no seed, but they brought a cutting to Kyrene, a sapling. A royal gift of wonder for the king.
Though he sounded angry, he was barely loud enough for Rand to understand. Anyone who could hear him would be able to hear the litter scraping across the ground, too. Rand kept on, only half listening.
They never make peace. Never. But they brought a sapling as a sign of peace. 500 years it grew. 500 years of peace with those who make no peace with strangers. Why did he cut it down?
Why?
Blood was the price for Avendor Aldera. Blood the price for Laman's pride.
He faded off into muttering once more. Tiredly, Rand wondered what fever dream Tam could be having now.
Avendasora? The Tree of Life was supposed to have all sorts of miraculous qualities, but none of the stories mentioned any sapling, or any they. There was only the one, and that belonged to the Green Man. Only that morning he might have felt foolish at musing over the Green Man and the Tree of Life. They were only stories.
Are they? Trollocs were just stories this morning. Maybe all the stories were as real as the news the peddlers and merchants brought. All the Gleeman's tales and all the stories told at night in front of the fireplace. Next he might actually meet the Green Man, or an Ogier giant, or a wild, black-veiled Aiel man. Tam was talking again, he realized, sometimes only murmuring, sometimes loud enough to understand. From time to time he stopped to pant for breath, then went on as if he thought he had been speaking the whole time.
Battles are always hot, even in the snow. Sweat heat, blood heat. Only death is cool. Slope of the mountain. Only place didn't stink of death. Had to get away from smell of it, sight of it. Heard a baby cry. The women fight alongside the men, sometimes. But why they had let her come, I don't... Gave birth there alone, before she died of her wounds. Covered the child with her cloak, but the wind... Blown the cloak away. Child blue with the cold. Should have been dead, too, crying there. Crying in the snow... I couldn't just leave a child. No children of our own. Always knew you wanted children. I knew you'd take it to your heart, Kari. Yes, lass. Rand is a good name. A good name.
Suddenly Rand's legs lost the little strength they had. Stumbling, he fell to his knees. Tam moaned with the jolt, and the strip of blanket cut into Rand's shoulders, but he was not aware of either. If a Trolloc had leaped up in front of him right then, he would have just stared at it. He looked over his shoulder at Tam, who had sunk back into wordless murmurs.
Fever dreams, he thought dully. Fevers always brought bad dreams, and this was a night for nightmares, even without a fever.
You are my father,
he said aloud, stretching back a hand to touch Tam, and I am...
The fever was worse, much worse. Grimly, he struggled to his feet. Tam murmured something, but Rand refused to listen to any more. Throwing his weight against the improvised harness, he tried to put all of his mind into taking one leaden step after another, into reaching the safety of Emmons Field. But he could not stop the echo in the back of his mind.
He's my father. It was just a fever dream. He's my father. It was just a fever dream. Light. Who am I?
Chapter 7. Out of the Woods. Gray first light came while Rand still trudged through the forest. At first he did not really see. When he finally did, he stared at the fading darkness in surprise. No matter what his eyes told him, he could hardly believe he had spent all night trying to travel the distance from the farm to Emmons Field. Of course, the quarry road by day, rocks and all, was a far cry from the woods by night. On the other hand, it seemed days since he had seen the black-cloaked rider on the road, weeks since he and Tam had gone in for their supper. He no longer felt the strip of cloth digging into his shoulders, but then he felt nothing in his shoulders except numbness, nor in his feet, for that matter. In between, it was another matter. His breath came in labored pants that had long since set his throat and lungs to burning, and hunger twisted his stomach into queasy sickness. Tam had fallen silent some time before. Rand was not sure how long it had been since the murmurs ceased, but he did not dare halt now to check on Tam. If he stopped, he would never be able to force himself to start out again. Anyway, whatever Tam's condition, he could do nothing beyond what he was doing. The only hope lay ahead in the village. He tried wearily to increase his pace, but his wooden legs continued their slow plod. He barely even noticed the cold or the wind. Vaguely, he caught the smell of wood smoke. At least he was almost there if he could smell the village chimneys. A tired smile had only begun on his face, though, when it turned to a frown. Smoke lay heavy in the air. Too heavy. With the weather, a fire might well be blazing away on every hearth in the village, but the smoke was still too strong. In his mind, he saw again the Trollocs on the road. Trollocs coming from the east, from the direction of Emmons Field. He peered ahead, trying to make out the first houses, and ready to shout for help at the first sight of anyone, even Sen Bui or one of the Coplins. A small voice in the back of his head told him to hope someone there could still give help. Suddenly a house became visible through the last bare-branched trees, and it was all he could do to keep his feet moving. Hope turning to sharp despair, he staggered into the village. Charred piles of rubble stood in the places of half the houses of Emmons Field. Soot-coated brick chimneys thrust like dirty fingers from heaps of blackened timbers. Thin wisps of smoke still rose from the ruins. Grimy-faced villagers, some yet in their nightclothes, poked through the ashes, here pulling free a cookpot, there simply prodding forlornly at the wreckage with a stick. What little had been rescued from the flames dotted the streets. Tall mirrors and polished sideboards and high chests stood in the dust among chairs and tables, buried under bedding, cooking utensils, and meager piles of clothing and personal belongings. The destruction seemed scattered at random through the village. Five houses marched untouched in one row, while in another place a lone survivor stood surrounded by desolation. On the far side of the Winespring Water, the three huge Beltane bonfires roared, tended by a cluster of men. Thick columns of black smoke bent northward with the wind, flecked by careless sparks. One of Master Alvir's Durin stallions was dragging something Rand could not make out over the ground toward the wagon bridge and the flames. Before he was well out of the trees, a sooty-faced Haral Luhan hurried to him, clutching a woodsman's axe in one thick-fingered hand. The burly blacksmith's ash-smeared nightshirt hung to his boots, the angry red welt of a burn across his chest showing through a ragged tear. He dropped to one knee beside the litter. Tam's eyes were closed, and his breathing came low and hard.
"Trollocs, boy?" Master Luhan asked in a smoke-hoarse voice. "Here, too. Here, too. Well, we may have been luckier than anyone has a right to be, if you can credit it. He needs the wisdom. Now where in the light is she? Egwene!"
Egwene, running by with her arms full of bedsheets torn into bandages, looked around at them without slowing. Her eyes stared at something in the far distance. Dark circles made them appear even larger than they actually were. Then she saw Rand and stopped, drawing a shuddering breath.
"Oh no, Rand! Not your father! Is he... Come, I'll take you to Nynaeve!"
Rand was too tired, too stunned to speak. All through the night, Emmons Field had been a haven where he and Tam would be safe. Now all he could seem to do was stare in dismay at her smoke-stained dress. He noticed odd details as if they were very important. The buttons down the back of her dress were done up crookedly, and her hands were clean. He wondered why her hands were clean when smudges of soot marked her cheeks. Master Luhan seemed to understand what had come over him. Laying his axe across the shafts, the blacksmith picked up the rear of the litter and gave it a gentle push, prodding him to follow Egwene. He stumbled after her as if walking in his sleep. Briefly, he wondered how Master Luhan knew the creatures were Trollocs, but it was a fleeting thought. If Tam could recognize them, there was no reason why Haral Luhan could not.
"All the stories are real," he muttered.
"So it seems, lad," the blacksmith said. "So it seems."
Rand only half heard. He was concentrating on following Egwene's slender shape. He had pulled himself together just enough to wish she would hurry, though in truth she was keeping her pace to what the two men could manage with their burden. She led them halfway down the green to the Calder House. Char blackened the edges of its thatch, and smut stained the whitewashed walls. Of the houses on either side, only the foundation stones were left, and two piles of ash and burned timbers. One had been the house of Baron Thane, one of the Miller's brothers. The other had been Abel Cawthon's, Matt's father. Even the chimneys had toppled.
"Wait here,"
Egwene said, and gave them a look as if expecting an answer. When they only stood there, she muttered something under her breath, then dashed inside.
"Matt," Rand said, "is he?"
"He's alive,"
the blacksmith said. He set down his end of the litter and straightened slowly.
"I saw him only a little while ago. It's a wonder any of us are alive. The way they came after my house in the forge, you'd have thought I had gold and jewels in there. Elsbeth cracked one's skull with a frying pan. She took one look at the ashes of our house this morning and set out hunting around the village with the biggest hammer she could dig out of what's left of the forge, just in case any of them hid instead of running away. I could almost pity the thing if she finds one."
He nodded to the Calder house.
"Mistress Calder and a few others took in some of those who were hurt, the ones with no home of their own still standing. When the Wisdom's seen Tam, we'll find him a bed. The inn, maybe. The mayor offered it already, but Nynaeve said the hurt folk would heal better if there weren't so many of them together."
Rand sank to his knees. Shrugging out of his blanket harness, he wearily busied himself with checking Tam's covers. Tam never moved or made a sound, even when Rand's wooden hands jostled him. But he was still breathing, at least.
"My father. The other was just the fever talking. What if they come back?"
he said dully.
"The wheel weaves as the wheel wills," Master Lujan said uneasily. "If they come back, well, they're gone now. So we pick up the pieces, build up what's been torn down."
He sighed, his face going slack as he knuckled the small of his back. For the first time, Rand realized that the heavy-set man was as tired as he was himself, if not more so. The blacksmith looked at the village, shaking his head.
"I don't suppose today will be much of a bell time, but we'll make it through. We always have."
Abruptly, he took up his axe, and his face firmed.
"There's work waiting for me. Don't you worry, lad. The Wisdom will take good care of him, and the Light will take care of us all. And if the Light doesn't, well, we'll just take care of ourselves. Remember, we're Two Rivers folk."
Still on his knees, Rand looked at the village as the blacksmith walked away, really looked for the first time. Master Lujan was right, he thought, and was surprised that he was not surprised by what he saw. People still dug in the ruins of their homes, but even in the short time he had been there, more of them had begun to move with a sense of purpose. He could almost feel the growing determination. But, he wondered, they had seen Trollocs. Had they seen the black-cloaked rider? Had they felt his hatred? Nynaeve and Egwene appeared from the Calder house, and he sprang to his feet. Or rather, he tried to spring to his feet. It was more of a stumbling lurch that almost put him on his face in the dust. The Wisdom dropped to her knees beside the litter without giving him so much as a glance. Her face and dress were even dirtier than Egwene's, and the same dark circles lined her eyes, though her hands, too, were clean. She felt Tam's face and thumbed open his eyelids. With a frown, she pulled down the coverings and eased the bandage aside to look at the wound. Before Rand could see what lay underneath, she had replaced the wadded cloth. Sighing, she smoothed the blanket and cloak back up to Tam's neck with a gentle touch, as if tucking a child in for the night.
"There's nothing I can do," she said.
She had to put her hands on her knees to straighten up.
"I'm sorry, Rand."
For a moment he stood, not understanding, as she started back to the house. Then he scrambled after her and pulled her around to face him.
"He's dying," he cried. "I know,"
she said simply, and he sagged with the matter-of-factness of it.
"You have to do something. You have to. You're the Wisdom."
Pain twisted her face, but only for an instant. Then she was all hollow-eyed resolve again, her voice emotionless and firm.
"Yes, I am. I know what I can do with my medicines, and I know when it's too late. Don't you think I would do something if I could? But I can't. I can't, Rand. And there are others who need me. People I can help." "I brought him to you as quickly as I could," he mumbled.
Even with the village in ruins, there had been the Wisdom for hope. With that gone, he was empty.
"I know you did," she said gently,
She touched his cheek with her hand. It isn't your fault. You did the best anyone could. I am sorry, Rand, but I have others to tend to. Our troubles are just beginning, I'm afraid. Vacantly, he stared after her until the door of the house closed behind her. He could not make any thought come, except that she would not help. Suddenly he was knocked back a step as Egwene cannoned into him, throwing her arms around him. Her hug was hard enough to bring a grunt from him any other time. Now he only looked silently at the door, behind which his hopes had vanished.
"I'm so sorry, Rand," she said against his chest. "Light, I wish there was something I could do."
Numbly, he put his arms around her.
"I know. I have to do something, Egwene. I don't know what, but I can't just let him..."
His voice broke, and she hugged him harder.
"Egwene!"
At Nynaeve's shout from the house, Egwene jumped.
"Egwene, I need you. And wash your hands again."
She pushed herself free from Rand's arms.
"She needs my help, Rand." "Egwene!"
He thought he heard a sob as she spun away from him. Then she was gone, and he was left alone beside the litter. For a moment he looked down at Tam, feeling nothing but hollow helplessness. Suddenly his face hardened.
"The mayor will know what to do," he said,
lifting the shafts once more.
"The mayor will know."
Bran Alvir always knew what to do. With weary obstinacy, he set out for the Wine Spring Inn. Another of the Durin stallions passed him, its harness straps tied around the ankles of a big shape, draped with a dirty blanket. Arms covered with coarse hair dragged in the dirt behind the blanket, and one corner was pushed up to reveal a goat's horn. The Two Rivers was no place for stories to become horribly real. If Trollocs belonged anywhere, it was in the world outside, for places where they had Aes Sedai and false dragons, and the light alone knew what else come to life out of the tales of Gleeman. Not the Two Rivers, not Emmons Field. As he made his way down the green, people called to him, some from the ruins of their homes, asking if they could help. He heard them only as murmurs in the background, even when they walked alongside him for a distance as they spoke. Without really thinking about it, he managed words that said he needed no help, that everything was being taken care of. When they left him, with worried looks and sometimes a comment about sending Nynaeve to him, he noticed that just as little. All he let himself be aware of was the purpose he had fixed in his head. Bran Alvir could do something to help Tam. What that could be, he tried not to dwell on. But the mayor would be able to do something, to think of something. The inn had almost completely escaped the destruction that had taken half the village. A few scorch marks marred its walls, but the red roof tiles glittered in the sunlight as brightly as ever. All that was left of the peddler's wagon, though, were blackened iron wheel rims leaning against the charred wagon box, now on the ground. The big round hoops that had held up the canvas cover slanted crazily, each at a different angle. Tom Marilyn sat cross-legged on the old foundation stones, carefully snipping singed edges from the patches on his cloak with a pair of small scissors. He set down cloak and scissors when Rand drew near. Without asking if Rand needed or wanted help, he hopped down and picked up the back of the litter.
"Inside? Of course, of course. Don't you worry, boy. Your wisdom will take care of him. I've watched her work since last night, and she has a deft touch and a sure skill. It could be a lot worse. Some died last night. Not many, perhaps, but any at all are too many for me. Old Fane just disappeared, and that's the worst of all. Trollocs will eat anything. You should thank the light your father's still here, and alive for the wisdom to heal."
Rand blotted out the words, "He is my father," reducing the voice to meaningless sound that he noticed no more than a fly's buzzing. He could not bear any more sympathy, any more attempts to boost his spirits, not now. Not until Bran Alvir told him how to help Tam. Suddenly he found himself facing something scrawled on the inn door. A curving line scratched with a charred stick. A charcoal teardrop balanced on its point. So much had happened that it hardly surprised him to find the dragon's fang marked on the door of the Winespring Inn. Why anyone would want to accuse the innkeeper or his family of evil, or bring the inn bad luck, was beyond him. But the knight had convinced him of one thing. Anything was possible. Anything at all. At a push from the gleeman, he lifted the latch and went in. The common room was empty except for Bran Alvir, and cold, too, for no one had found time to lay a fire. The mayor sat at one of the tables, dipping his pen in an inkwell with a frown of concentration on his face, and his gray-fringed head bent over a sheet of parchment. Nightshirt tucked hastily into his trousers, and bagging around his considerable waist, he absently scratched at one bare foot with the toes of the other. His feet were dirty, as if he had been outside more than once without bothering about boots, despite the cold.
"What's your trouble?"
he demanded without looking up.
"Be quick with it. I have 24 things to do right this minute, and more that should have been done an hour ago. So I have little time or patience. Well, out with it."
"Master Alvier," Rand said. "It's my father."
The mayor's head jerked up.
"Rand! Tam!"
He threw down the pen and knocked over his chair as he leaped up.
"Perhaps the light hasn't abandoned us altogether. I was afraid you were both dead. Bella galloped into the village an hour after the Trollocs left, lathered and blowing as if she'd run all the way from the farm. And I thought, no time for that now. We'll take him upstairs."
He seized the rear of the litter, shouldering the gleeman out of the way.
"You go get the wisdom, Master Marilyn, and tell her I said hurry, or I'll know the reason why. Rest easy, Tam. We'll soon have you in a good soft bed. Go, gleeman, go!"
Tom Marilyn vanished through the doorway before Rand could speak.
"Nynaeve wouldn't do anything. She said she couldn't help him. I hoped you'd think of something."
Master Alvier looked at Tam more sharply, then shook his head.
"We'll see, boy. We'll see."
But he no longer sounded confident.
"Let's get him into a bed. He can rest easy, at least."
Rand let himself be prodded toward the stairs at the back of the common room. He tried hard to keep his certainty that somehow Tam would be all right. But it had been thin to begin with, he realized, and the sudden doubt in the mayor's voice shook him. On the second floor of the inn, at the front, were half a dozen snug, well-appointed rooms with windows overlooking the green. Mostly they were used by the peddlers, or people down from Watch Hill or up from Devon Ride. But the merchants who came each year were often surprised to find such comfortable rooms. Three of them were taken now, and the mayor hurried Rand to one of the unused ones. Quickly the down comforter and blankets were stripped back on the wide bed, and Tam was transferred to the thick feather mattress with goose-down pillows tucked under his head. He made no sound beyond hoarse breathing as he was moved, not even a groan, but the mayor brushed away Rand's concern, telling him to set a fire to take the chill off the room. While Rand dug wood and kindling from the wood box next to the fireplace, Bran threw back the curtains on the room, letting in the morning light, then began to gently wash Tam's face. By the time the gleeman returned, the blaze on the hearth was warming the room.
"She will not come,"
Tom Marilyn announced as he stalked into the room. He glared at Rand, his bushy white brows, drawing down sharply.
"You didn't tell me she had seen him already. She almost took my head off."
"I thought, I don't know, maybe the mayor could do something, could make her see."
Hands clenched in anxious fists, Rand turned from the fireplace to Bran.
"Master Alvier, what can I do?"
The rotund man shook his head helplessly. He laid a freshly dampened cloth on Tam's forehead and avoided meeting Rand's eye.
"I can't just watch him die, Master Alvier. I have to do something."
The gleeman shifted as if to speak. Rand rounded on him eagerly.
"Do you have an idea? I'll try anything."
"I was just wondering," Tom said, tamping his long-stemmed pipe with his thumb, "if the mayor knew who scrawled the dragon's fang on his door."
He peered into the bowl, then looked at Tam and replaced the unlit pipe between his teeth with a sigh.
"Someone seems not to like him anymore. Or maybe it's his guests they don't like."
Rand gave him a disgusted look and turned away to stare into the fire. His thoughts danced like the flames, and like the flames, they concentrated fixedly on one thing. He would not give up. He could not just stand there and watch Tam die.
"My father," he thought fiercely. "My father."
Once the fever was gone, that could be cleared up as well. But the fever first.
Only how?
Bran Alvir's mouth tightened as he looked at Rand's back, and the glare he directed at the gleeman would have given a bear pause, but Tom just waited expectantly, as if he had not noticed it.
"It's probably the work of one of the Congers or a Coplin," the mayor said finally, "though the light alone knows which. They're a large brood, and if there's ill to be said of someone, or even if there isn't, they'll say it. They make Senbui sound honey-tongued."
"That wagon load who came in just before dawn?" the gleeman asked. "They hadn't so much as smelled a Trolloc, and all they wanted to know was when festival was going to start, as if they couldn't see half the village in ashes."
Master Alvear nodded grimly.
One branch of the family, but none of them are very different. That fool Darl Copland spent half the night demanding I put Mistress Moraine and the Master Lan out of the inn, out of the village, as if there would be any village at all left without them.
Rand had only half listened to the conversation, but this last tugged him to speak. What did they do?
Why, she called ball lightning out of the clear night sky, Master Alvear replied. Sent it darting straight at the Trollocs. You've seen trees shattered by it. The Trollocs stood it no better.
Moraine? Rand said incredulously, and the mayor nodded.
Mistress Moraine. And Master Lan was a whirlwind with that sword of his. His sword? The man himself is a weapon, and in 10 places at once, or so it seemed. Burn me, but I still wouldn't believe it if I couldn't step outside and see.
He rubbed a hand over his bald head.
Winter night visits just beginning, our hands full of presents and honey cakes and our heads full of wine. Then the dogs snarling, and suddenly the two of them burst out of the inn, running through the village shouting about Trollocs. I thought they'd had too much wine. After all, Trollocs? Then, before anyone knew what was happening, those things were right in the streets with us, slashing at people with their swords, torching houses, howling to freeze a man's blood.
He made a sound of disgust in his throat.
We just ran like chickens with a fox in the henyard till Master Lan put some backbone into us.
No need to be so hard, Tom said. You did as well as anyone could. Not every Trolloc lying out there fell to the two of them. Yes, well,
Master Alvear gave himself a shake.
It's still almost too much to believe. An Aes Sedai in Emmons Field, and Master Lan is a warder.
An Aes Sedai? Rand whispered. She can't be. I talked to her. She isn't. She doesn't.
Did you think they wore signs? The mayor said wryly. Aes Sedai painted across their backs, and maybe danger, stay away?
Suddenly he slapped his forehead.
Aes Sedai! I'm an old fool and losing my wits. There's a chance, Rand, if you're willing to take it. I can't tell you to do it, and I don't know if I'd have the nerve if it were me.
A chance? Rand said. I'll take any chance if it'll help.
Aes Sedai can heal, Rand. Burn me, lad, you've heard the stories. They can cure where medicines fail. Gleeman, you should have remembered that better than I. Gleeman's tales are full of Aes Sedai. Why didn't you speak up instead of letting me flail around?
I'm a stranger here, Tom said, looking longingly at his unlit pipe. And Goodman Copland isn't the only one who wants nothing to do with Aes Sedai. Best the idea came from you.
An Aes Sedai,
Rand muttered, trying to make the woman who had smiled at him fit the stories. Help from an Aes Sedai was sometimes worse than no help at all, so the stories said, like poison in a pie, and their gifts always had a hook in them, like fish bait. Suddenly the coin in his pocket, the coin Moraine had given him, seemed like a burning coal. It was all he could do not to rip it out of his coat and throw it out the window.
Nobody wants to get involved with Aes Sedai, lad, the mayor said slowly. It is the only chance I can see, but it's still no small decision. I cannot make it for you, but I have seen nothing but good from Mistress Moraine. Moraine Sedai, I should call her, I suppose. Sometimes,
he gave a meaningful look at Tam, you have to take a chance, even if it's a poor one.
Some of the stories are exaggerated in a way, Tom added, as if the words were being dragged from him. Some of them. Besides, boy, what choice do you have?
None,
Rand sighed. Tam still had not moved a muscle. His eyes were sunken as if he had been sick a week.
I'll go find her.
The other side of the bridges, the Gleeman said, where they are disposing of the dead Trollocs.
But be careful, boy. Aes Sedai do what they do for reasons of their own, and they aren't always the reasons others think.
The last was a shout that followed Rand through the door. He had to hold on to the sword hilt to keep the scabbard from tangling in his legs as he ran, but he would not take the time to remove it. He clattered down the stairs and dashed out of the inn, tiredness forgotten for the moment. A chance for Tam, however small, was enough to overcome a night without sleep, for a time at least. That the chance came from an Aes Sedai, or what the price of it might be, he did not want to consider. And as for actually facing an Aes Sedai, He took a deep breath and tried to move faster.
The bonfire stood well beyond the last houses to the north on the west side of the road to Watch Hill. The wind still carried the oily black columns of smoke away from the village, but even so, a sickly sweet stink filled the air, like a roast left hours too long on the spit. Rand gagged at the smell, then swallowed hard when he realized its source. A fine thing to do with Beltane fires. The men tending the fires had cloths tied over their noses and mouths, but their grimaces made it plain the vinegar dampening the cloths was not enough. Even if it did kill the stench, they still knew the stench was there, and they still knew what they were doing. Two of the men were untying the harness straps of one of the big Durans from a trollic's ankles. Lan, squatting beside the body, had tossed back the blanket enough to reveal the trollic's shoulders and goat-snouted head. As Rand trotted up, the warder unfastened a metal badge, a blood-red enameled trident, from one spiked shoulder of the trollic's shirt of black mail.
"Kobol," he announced.
He bounced the badge on his palm and snatched it out of the air with a growl. "That makes 7 bands so far." Moraine, seated cross-legged on the ground a short distance off, shook her head tiredly. A walking staff covered from end to end in carved vines and flowers lay across her knees, and her dress had the rumpled look of having been worn too long.
7 bands. 7. That many have not acted together since the Trolloc Wars.
Bad news piles on bad news. I'm afraid, Lan. I thought we had gained a march, but we may be further behind than ever.
Rand stared at her, unable to speak.
An Aes Sedai. He had been trying to convince himself that she would not look any different now that he knew who... what he was looking at. And to his surprise, she did not. She was no longer quite so pristine, not with wisps of her hair sticking out in all directions, and a faint streak of soot across her nose, yet not really different either. Surely there must be something about an Aes Sedai to mark her for what she was. On the other hand, if outward appearance reflected what was inside, and if the stories were true, then she should look closer to a Trolloc than to a more than handsome woman whose dignity was not dented by sitting in the dirt. And she could help Tam. Whatever the cost, there was that before anything else. He took a deep breath.
"Mistress Moraine, I mean, Moraine Sedai."
Both turned to look at him, and he froze under her gaze. Not the calm, smiling gaze he remembered from the green. Her face was tired, but her dark eyes were a hawk's eyes.
"Aes Sedai, breakers of the world, puppeteers who pulled strings and made thrones and nations dance in designs only the women from Tar Valon knew."
"A little more light in the darkness," the Aes Sedai murmured. She raised her voice.
"How are your dreams, Randall Thor?"
He stared at her.
"My dreams?"
"A nut like that can give a man bad dreams, Rand. If you have nightmares, you must tell me of it. I can help with bad dreams, sometimes."
"There's nothing wrong with my... it's my father. He's hurt. It's not much more than a scratch, but the fever is burning him up. The wisdom won't help. She says she can't. But the stories..."
She raised an eyebrow, and he stopped and swallowed hard.
"Light. Is there a story with an Aes Sedai where she isn't a villain?"
He looked at the warder, but Lan appeared more interested in the dead Trolloc than in anything Rand might say. Fumbling his way under her eyes, he went on.
It said Aes Sedai can heal. If you can help him, anything you can do for him, whatever the cost, I mean...
He took a deep breath and finished up in a rush.
"I'll pay any price in my power if you help him, anything."
"Any price," Moraine mused, half to herself. "We will speak of prices later, Rand, if at all. I can make no promises. Your wisdom knows what she is about. I will do what I can, but it is beyond my power to stop the wheel from turning."
"Death comes sooner or later to everyone," the warder said grimly, "unless they serve the Dark One, and only fools are willing to pay that price."
Moraine made a clucking sound.
"Do not be so gloomy, Lan. We have some reason to celebrate. A small one, but a reason."
She used the staff to pull herself to her feet.
"Take me to your father, Rand. I will help him as much as I am able. Too many here have refused to let me help at all, They have heard the stories, too, she added dryly.
He's at the inn, Rand said. This way. And thank you. Thank you.
They followed, but his pace took him quickly ahead. He slowed impatiently for them to catch up, then darted ahead again and had to wait again.
Please hurry,
he urged, so caught up in actually getting help for Tam that he never considered the temerity of prodding an Aes Sedai.
The fever is burning him up.
Lan glared at him.
Can't you see she's tired? Even with an Angreal, what she did last night was like running around the village with a sack of stones on her back. I don't know that you are worth it, sheepherder, no matter what she says.
Rand blinked and held his tongue.
Gently, my friend, Moraine said.
Without slowing her pace, she reached up to pat the warder's shoulder. He towered over her protectively, as if he could give her strength just by being close.
You think only of taking care of me.
Why should he not think the same of his father? Lan scowled, but fell silent.
I am coming as quickly as I can, Rand, I promise you.
The fierceness of her eyes, or the calm of her voice, not gentle exactly, more firmly in command, Rand did not know which to believe. Or perhaps they did go together.
Aes Sedai.
He was committed now. He matched his stride to theirs and tried not to think of what the price might be that they would talk about later. Chapter 8. A Place of Safety. While he was still coming through the door, Rand's eyes went to his father. His father, no matter what anyone said. Tamanap moved an inch. His eyes were still shut, and his breath came in labored gasps, low and rasping. The white-haired gleeman cut off a conversation with the mayor, who was bent over the bed again, tending Tam, and gave Moraine an uneasy look. The Aes Sedai ignored him. Indeed, she ignored everyone except for Tam. But at him she stared with an intent frown. Tom stuck his unlit pipe between his teeth, then snatched it out again and glowered at it.
"Man cannot even smoke in peace," he muttered. "I'd better make sure some farmer doesn't steal my cloak to keep his cow warm. At least I can have my pipe out there."
He hurried out of the room. Lan stared after him, his angular face as expressionless as a rock.
"I do not like that man. There is something about him I don't trust. I did not see a hair of him last night."
"He was there," Brand said, watching Moraine uncertainly. "He must have been. His cloak did not get singed in front of the fireplace."
Rand did not care if the gleeman had spent the night hiding in the stable.
"My father," he said to Moraine pleadingly.
Bran opened his mouth, but before he could speak, Moraine said,
"Leave me with him, Master Alvear. There is nothing you can do here now, except get in my way."
For a minute, Bran hesitated, torn between dislike of being ordered about in his own inn and reluctance to disobey an Aes Sedai. Finally, he straightened up to clap Rand on the shoulder.
"Come along, boy. Let us leave Moraine Sedai to her... There's plenty you can give me a hand with downstairs. Before you know it, Tam will be shouting for his pipe and a mug of ale."
"Can I stay?"
Rand spoke to Moraine, though she did not really seem to be aware of anyone besides Tam. Bran's hand tightened, but Rand ignored him.
"Please, I'll keep out of your way. You won't even know I am here. He's my father,"
he added with a fierceness that startled him and widened the mayor's eyes in surprise. Rand hoped the others put it down to tiredness or the strain of dealing with an Aes Sedai.
"Yes, yes," Moraine said impatiently.
She had tossed her cloak and staff carelessly across the only chair in the room, and now she pushed up the sleeves of her gown, baring her arms to her elbows. Her attention never really left Tam, even while she spoke.
"Sit over there. And you too, Lan."
She gestured vaguely in the direction of a long bench against the wall. Her eyes traveled slowly from Tam's feet to his head, but Rand had the prickly feeling that she was looking beyond him in some fashion.
"You may talk if you wish," she went on absently, "but do it quietly. Now you go, Master Alvear. This is a sick room, not a gathering hall. See that I am not disturbed."
The mayor grumbled under his breath, though not loudly enough to catch her attention, of course, squeezed Rand's shoulder again, then obediently, if reluctantly, closed the door behind him. Muttering to herself, the Aes Sedai knelt beside the bed and rested her hands lightly on Tam's chest. She closed her eyes, and for a long time she neither moved nor made a sound. In the stories, Aes Sedai wonders were always accompanied by flashes and thunderclaps or other signs to indicate mighty works and great powers. The power, the one power, drawn from the true source that drove the Wheel of Time. That was not something Rand wanted to think about, the power involved with Tam, himself in the same room where the power might be used. In the same village was bad enough. For all he could tell, though, Moraine might just as well have gone to sleep. But he thought Tam's breathing sounded easier. She must be doing something. So intent was he that he jumped when Lan spoke softly.
"That is a fine weapon you wear. Is there by chance a heron on the blade as well?"
For a moment, Rand stared at the warder, not grasping what it was he was talking about. He had completely forgotten Tam's sword in the lather of dealing with an Aes Sedai. It did not seem so heavy anymore.
"Yes, there is. What is she doing?"
"I'd not have thought to find a heron-marked sword in a place like this," Lan said.
"It belongs to my father."
He glanced at Lan's sword, the hilt just visible at the edge of his cloak. The two swords did look a good deal alike, except that no herons showed on the warders. He swung his eyes back to the bed. Tam's breathing did sound easier. The rasp was gone. He was sure of it.
"He bought it a long time ago."
"Strange thing for a sheepherder to buy."
Rand spared a sidelong look for Lan. For a stranger to wonder about the sword was prying. For a warder to do it. Still, he felt he had to say something.
"He never had any use for it that I know of. He said it had no use. Until last night, anyway. I didn't even know he had it till then."
"He called it useless, did he? He must not always have thought so."
Lan touched the scabbard at Rand's waist briefly with one finger.
"There are places where the heron is a symbol of the master swordsman. That blade must have traveled a strange road to end up with a sheepherder in the Two Rivers."
Rand ignored the unspoken question. Moraine still had not moved. Was the Aes Sedai doing anything? He shivered and rubbed his arms, not sure he really wanted to know what she was doing. An Aes Sedai. A question of his own popped into his head then, one he did not want to ask, one he needed an answer to.
"The mayor..."
He cleared his throat and took a deep breath.
"The mayor said the only reason there's anything left of the village is because of you and her."
He made himself look at the warder.
"If you had been told about a man in the woods, a man who made people afraid just by looking at them, would that have warned you? A man whose horse doesn't make any noise, and the wind doesn't touch his cloak? Would you have known what was going to happen? Could you and Moraine Sedai have stopped it if you'd known about him?"
"Not without half a dozen of my sisters," Moraine said, and Rand started. She still knelt by the bed, but she had taken her hands from Tam and half turned to face the two of them on the bench. Her voice never raised, but her eyes pinned Rand to the wall.
"Had I known when I left Tar Valon that I would find Trollox and Murdral here, I would have brought half a dozen of them, a dozen, if I had to drag them by the scruffs of their necks. By myself, a month's warning would have made little difference. Perhaps none. There is only so much one person can do, even calling on the One Power. And there were probably well over 100 Trollocs scattered around this district last night. An entire fist."
"It would still have been good to know," Lan said sharply, the sharpness directed at Rand. "When did you see him, exactly, and where?"
"That's of no consequence now," Moraine said. "I will not have the boy thinking he is to blame for something when he is not. I am as much to blame. That accursed raven yesterday, the way it behaved, should have warned me. And you too, my old friend," her tongue clicked angrily. "I was overconfident to the point of arrogance, sure that the Dark One's touch could not have spread so far, nor so heavily, not yet." "So sure."
Rand blinked.
"The raven? I don't understand."
"Carrion eaters." Lan's mouth twisted in distaste. "The Dark One's minions often find spies among creatures that feed on death. Ravens and crows, mainly. Rats in the cities, sometimes."
A quick shiver ran through Rand.
"Ravens and crows as spies of the Dark One? There were ravens and crows everywhere now." "The Dark One's touch," Moraine had said. "The Dark One was always there, he knew that. But if you tried to walk in the light, tried to live a good life, and did not name him, he could not harm you."
That was what everybody believed, what everybody learned with his mother's milk. But Moraine seemed to be saying... His glance fell on Tam, and everything else was pushed right out of his head. His father's face was noticeably less flushed than it had been, and his breathing sounded almost normal. Rand would have leaped up if Lan had not caught his arm.
"You've done it!"
Moraine shook her head and sighed. "Not yet. I hope it is only not yet. Trolloc weapons are made at forges in the valley called Thakandar, on the very slopes of Shale Ghul itself. Some of them take a taint from that place, a stain of evil in the metal. Those tainted blades make wounds that will not heal unaided, or cause deadly fevers, strange sicknesses that medicines cannot touch. I have soothed your father's pain, but the mark, the taint, is still in him. Left alone, it will grow again and consume him."
"But you won't leave it alone."
Rand's words were half plea, half command. He was shocked to realize he had spoken to an Aes Sedai like that, but she seemed not to notice his tone.
"I will not," she agreed simply. "I am very tired, Rand, and I have had no chance to rest since last night. Ordinarily, it would not matter, but for this kind of hurt..." "This," she took a small bundle of white silk from her pouch, "is an Angrial." She saw his expression. "You know of Angrial, then?"
"Good."
Unconsciously, he leaned back further away from her and what she held. A few stories mentioned Angrial, those relics of the Age of Legends that Aes Sedai used to perform their greatest wonders. He was startled to see her unwrap a smooth, ivory figurine, age-darkened to deep brown. No longer than her hand, it was a woman in flowing robes, with long hair falling about her shoulders.
"We have lost the making of these," she said. "So much is lost, perhaps never to be found again. So few remain, the Amerlin seat almost did not allow me to take this one. It is well for Emmons Field and for your father that she did give her permission. But you must not hope too much. Now, even with it, I can do little more than I could have without it yesterday. And the taint is strong. It has had time to fester."
"You can help him," Rand said fervently. "I know you can."
Moraine smiled, a bare curving of her lips.
"We shall see."
Then she turned back to Tam. One hand she laid on his forehead. The other cupped the ivory figure. Eyes closed, her face took on a look of concentration. She scarcely seemed to breathe.
"That rider you spoke of," Lan said quietly. "The one who made you afraid. That was surely a Murdral."
"A Murdral?" Rand exclaimed.
"But
Fades are 20 feet tall and..."
The words faded away under the warder's mirthless grin.
"Sometimes, sheepherder, stories make things larger than truth. Believe me, the truth is big enough with a half-man. Half-man, lurk, fade, shadow-man, the name depends on the land you're in, but they all mean Murdral. Fades are Trolloc spawn, throwbacks almost to the human stock the Dreadlords used to make the Trollocs. Almost. But if the human strain is made stronger, so is the taint that twists the Trollocs. Half-men have powers of a kind, the sort that stem from the Dark One. Only the weakest Aes Sedai would fail to be a match for a Fade, one against one. But many a good man and true has fallen to them. Since the wars that ended the Age of Legends, since the Forsaken were bound, they have been the brain that tells the Trolloc fists where to strike. In the days of the Trolloc Wars, half-men led the Trollocs in battle, under the Dreadlords.
"He scared me," Rand said faintly. "He just looked at me and..."
He shivered. "No need for shame, sheepherder. They scare me, too. I've seen men who have been soldiers all their lives freeze like a bird facing a snake when they confronted a half-man. In the north, in the borderlands along the Great Blight, there is a saying. The look of the eyeless is fear."
"The eyeless?" Rand said, and Lan nodded.
"Murdral see like eagles in darkness or in light, but they have no eyes. I can think of few things more dangerous than facing a Murdral.
Moraine Sedai and I both tried to kill the one that was here last night, and we failed every time. Halfmen have the Dark One's own luck. Rand swallowed.
A Trolloc said the Murdraw wanted to talk to me. I didn't know what it meant.
Lan's head jerked up. His eyes were blue stones.
You talked to a Trolloc?
Not exactly, Rand stammered.
The warder's gaze held him like a trap.
It talked to me. It said it wouldn't hurt me, that the Murdraw wanted to talk to me. Then it tried to kill me.
He licked his lips and rubbed his hand along the knobby leather of the sword hilt. In short, choppy sentences, he explained about returning to the farmhouse.
I killed it instead, he finished. By accident, really. It jumped at me, and I had the sword in my hand.
Lan's face softened slightly, if rock could be said to soften. Even so, that is something to speak of, sheepherder. Until last night, there were few men south of the borderlands who could say they had seen a Trolloc, much less killed one.
And fewer still who have slain a Trolloc alone and unaided, Moraine said wearily. It is done, Rand. Lan, help me up.
The warder sprang to her side, but he was no quicker than Rand, darting to the bed. Tam's skin was cool to the touch, though his face had a pale, washed-out look, as if he had spent far too long out of the sun. His eyes were still closed, but he drew the deep breaths of normal sleep.
He will be all right now? Rand asked anxiously.
With rest, yes, Moraine said. A few weeks in bed, and he will be as good as ever.
She walked unsteadily, despite holding Lan's arm. He swept her cloak and staff from the chair cushion for her to sit, and she eased herself down with a sigh. With a slow care, she rewrapped the Angrial and returned it to her pouch. Rand's shoulders shook. He bit his lip to keep from laughing. At the same time, he had to scrub a hand across his eyes to clear away tears.
Thank you.
In the age of legends, Moraine went on, some Aes Sedai could fan life and health to flame if only the smallest spark remained. Those days are gone, though, perhaps forever. So much was lost. Not just the making of Angreal, so much that could be done which we dare not even dream of, if we remember it at all. There are far fewer of us now. Some talents are all but gone, and many that remain seem weaker. Now there must be both will and strength for the body to draw on, and even the strongest of us can do nothing in the way of healing. It is fortunate that your father is a strong man, both in body and spirit. As it is, he used up much of his strength in the fight for life. But all that is left now is for him to recuperate. That will take time, but the taint is gone.
I can never repay you, he told her without taking his eyes from Tam. But anything I can do for you, I will. Anything at all.
He remembered the talk of prices then, and his promise. Kneeling beside Tam, he meant it even more than before, but it still was not easy to look at her.
Anything. As long as it does not hurt the village or my friends.
Moraine raised a hand dismissively.
If you think it is necessary. I would like to talk with you anyway. You will no doubt leave at the same time we do, and we can speak at length then.
Leave?
He exclaimed, scrambling to his feet.
Is it really that bad? Everyone looked to me as if they were ready to start rebuilding. We are pretty settled folk in the Two Rivers. Nobody ever leaves.
Rand.
And where would we go? Padan Fain said the weather is just as bad everywhere else. He was the peddler. The Trollocs.
Rand swallowed, wishing Tom Marilyn had not told him what Trollocs ate.
The best I can see to do is stay right here where we belong, in the Two Rivers, and put things back together. We have crops in the ground, and it has to warm enough for the shearing soon. I don't know who started this talk about leaving. One of the Coplins, I'll bet. But whoever it was...
Sheepherder, Lan broke in. You talk when you should be listening.
He blinked at both of them. He had been half-babbling, he realized, and he had rambled on while she tried to talk.
While an Aes Sedai tried to talk.
He wondered what to say, how to apologize, but Moraine smiled while he was still thinking.
I understand how you feel, Rand, she said. and he had the uncomfortable feeling that she really did.
"Think no more of it."
Her mouth tightened, and she shook her head. "I have handled this badly, I see. I should have rested first, I suppose. It is you who will be leaving, Rand. You who must leave for the sake of your village."
"Me?"
He cleared his throat and tried again.
"Me?"
It sounded a little better this time.
"Why do I have to go? I don't understand any of this. I don't want to go anywhere."
Moraine looked at Lan, and the warder unfolded his arms. He looked at Rand from under his leather headband, and Rand had the feeling of being weighed on invisible scales again.
"Did you know," Lan said suddenly, "that some homes were not attacked?"
"Half the village is in ashes," he protested,
but the warder waved it away.
"Some houses were only torched to create confusion. The Trollocs ignored them afterwards, and the people who fled from them as well, unless they actually got in the way of the true attack. Most of the people who've come in from the outlying farms never saw a hair of a Trolloc, and that only at a distance. Most never knew there was any trouble until they saw the village."
"I did hear about Darl Coplin," Rand said slowly. "I suppose it just didn't sink in."
"Two farms were attacked," Lan went on. "Yours and one other. Because of Beltane, everyone who lived at the second farm was already in the village. Many people were saved because the Murdral was ignorant of Two Rivers' customs. Festival and Winter Night made its task all but impossible, but it did not know that." Rand looked at Moraine, leaning back in the chair. But she said nothing, only watched him, a finger laid across her lips.
"Our farm and who else's?" he asked finally.
"The Ebarra farm," Lan replied. "Here in Emmonsfield they struck first at the forge and the blacksmith's house and Master Cawthon's house."
Rand's mouth was suddenly dry.
"That's crazy," he managed to get out,
then jumped as Moraine straightened.
"Not crazy, Rand," she said. "Purposeful.
The Trollocs did not come to Emmonsfield by happenstance, and they did not do what they did for the pleasure of killing and burning, however much that delighted them. They knew what, or rather who, they were after. The Trollocs came to kill or capture young men of a certain age who live near Emmonsfield."
"My age?"
Rand's voice shook, and he did not care.
"Light? Matt? What about Perrin?"
"Alive and well," Moraine assured him, "if a trifle sooty."
"Ban Craw and Lem Thane?"
"We're never in any danger," Lan said. "At least, no more than anyone else."
"But they saw the rider, the Fade, too, and they're the same age as I am."
"Master Craw's house was not even damaged," Moraine said,
"and the miller and his family slept through half the attack before the noise woke them. Ban is 10 months older than you, and Lem 8 months younger." She smiled dryly at his surprise.
"I told you I asked questions, and I also said young men of a certain age. You and your two friends are within weeks of one another. It was you three the Murdral sought, and none others."
Rand shifted uneasily, wishing she would not look at him like that, as if her eyes could pierce his brain and read what lay in every corner of it.
"What would they want with us? We're just farmers, shepherds."
"That is a question that has no answer in the Two Rivers," Moraine said quietly. "But the answer is important. Trollocs, where they have not been seen in almost 2,000 years, tells us that much."
"Lots of stories tell about Trolloc raids," Rand said stubbornly. "We just never had one here before. Warders fight Trollocs all the time."
Lan snorted.
"Boy, I expect to fight Trollocs along the Great Blight, but not here, nearly 600 leagues to the south. That was as hot a raid last night as I'd expect to see in Shinar, or any of the borderlands."
"In one of you," Moraine said. "Or all three. There is something the Dark One fears."
That's impossible."
Rand stumbled to the window and stared out at the village, at the people working among the ruins.
"I don't care what's happened. That is just impossible."
Something on the green caught his eye. He stared, then realized it was the blackened stump of the spring pole. A fine Beltane with a peddler and a gleeman, and not strangers.
He shivered and shook his head violently.
No, no, I'm a shepherd. The Dark One can't be interested in me.
It took a great deal of effort, Lan said grimly, to bring so many Trollocs so far without raising a hue and cry from the Borderlands to Camelin and beyond. I wish I knew how they did it. Do you really believe they went to all that bother just to burn a few houses?
They will be back, Moraine added. Rand had his mouth open to argue with Lan, but that brought him up short. He spun to face her.
Back? Can't you stop them? You did last night and you were surprised then. Now you know they are here.
Perhaps, Moraine replied. I could send to Tar Valon for some of my sisters. They might have time to make the journey before we need them. The Murdral knows I am here, too, and it probably will not attack, not openly at least, lacking reinforcements. More Murdral and more Trollocs. With enough Aes Sedai and enough warders, the Trollocs can be beaten off, though I cannot say how many battles it will take. A vision danced in his head of Emmons Field all in ashes, all the farms burned, and Watch Hill and Devon Ride and Tarin Ferry. All ashes and blood.
No,
he said, and felt a wrenching inside, as if he had lost his grip on something.
That's why I have to leave, isn't it? The Trollocs won't come back if I am not here.
A last trace of obstinacy made him add,
if they really are after me.
Moraine's eyebrows raised as if she were surprised that he was not convinced, but Lan said,
Are you willing to bet your village on it, sheepherder? Your whole two rivers?
Rand's stubbornness faded.
No,
he said again, and felt that emptiness inside again, too.
Perrin and Matt have to go too, don't they?
Leaving the two rivers, leaving his home and his father. At least Tam would get better. At least he would be able to hear him say all that on the quarry road had been nonsense.
We could go to Baerlon, I suppose, or even Camelin. I've heard there are more people in Camelin than in the whole two rivers. We'd be safe there.
He tried out a laugh that sounded hollow.
I used to daydream about seeing Camelin. I never thought it would come about like this.
There was a long silence, then Lan said,
I would not count on Camelin for safety. If the Murdral want you badly enough, they will find a way. Walls are a poor bar to a half-man, and you would be a fool not to believe they want you very badly indeed.
Rand thought his spirits had sunk as low as they possibly could, but at that they slid deeper.
There is a place of safety, Moraine said softly, and Rand's ears pricked up to listen. In Tar Valon, you would be among Aes Sedai and warders. Even during the Trolloc Wars, the forces of the Dark One feared to attack the Shining Walls. The one attempt was their greatest defeat until the very end. And Tar Valon holds all the knowledge we Aes Sedai have gathered since the time of madness. Some fragments even date from the Age of Legends. In Tar Valon, if anywhere, you will be able to learn why the Murdral want you, why the Father of Lies wants you. That I can promise.
A journey all the way to Tar Valon was almost beyond thinking. A journey to a place where he would be surrounded by Aes Sedai. Of course, Moraine had healed Tam, or it looked as if she had at least, but there were all those stories. It was uncomfortable enough to be in a room with one Aes Sedai, but to be in a city full of them? And she still had not demanded her price. There was always a price, so the stories said.
How long will my father sleep? He asked at last. I have to tell him. He shouldn't just wake and find me gone.
He thought he heard Lan give a sigh of relief. He looked at the water curiously, but Lan's face was as expressionless as ever.
It is unlikely he will wake before we depart, Moraine said. I mean to go soon after full dark. Even a single day of delay could be fatal. It will be best if you leave him a note. In the night? Rand said doubtfully, and Lan nodded.
The half-men will discover we are gone soon enough. There is no need to make things any easier for it than we must.
Rand fussed with his father's blankets. It was a very long way to Tar Valon.
In that case,
In that case, I had better go find Matt and Perrin. I will attend to that.
Moraine got to her feet briskly and donned her cloak with suddenly restored vigor. She put a hand on his shoulder, and he tried very hard not to flinch. She did not press hard, but it was an iron grip that held him as surely as a forked stick held a snake.
It will be best if we keep all of this just among us. Do you understand?
The same ones who put the dragon's fang on the inn door might make trouble if they knew.
I understand.
He drew a relieved breath when she took her hand away.
I will have Mistress Alvear bring you something to eat, she went on, just as if she had not noticed his reaction.
Then you need to sleep. It will be a hard journey tonight, even if you are rested. The door closed behind them, and Rand stood looking down at Tam. Looking at Tam, but seeing nothing. Not until that very minute had he realized that Emmonsfield was a part of him as much as he was a part of it. He realized it now because he knew that was what he had felt tearing loose. He was apart from the village now. The Shepherd of the Night wanted him. It was impossible. He was only a farmer. But the Trollocs had come, and Lan was right about one thing. He could not risk the village on the chance Moraine was wrong. He could not even tell anyone. The Coplins really would make trouble about something like that. He had to trust an Aes Sedai.
"Don't wake him now,"
Mistress Alvear said, as the mayor shut the door behind his wife and himself. The cloth-covered tray she carried gave off delicious, warm smells. She set it on the chest against the wall, then firmly moved Rand away from the bed.
"Mistress Moraine told me what he needs," she said softly, "and it does not include you falling on top of him from exhaustion. I have brought you a bite to eat. Don't let it get cold now."
"I wish you wouldn't call her that," Bran said peevishly. "Moraine Sedai is proper. She might get mad."
Mistress Alvear gave him a pat on the cheek.
"You just leave me to worry about that. She and I had a long talk, and keep your voice down. If you wake Tam, you'll have to answer to me and Moraine Sedai."
She put an emphasis on Moraine's title that made Bran's insistence seem foolish.
"The two of you keep out of my way."
With a fond smile for her husband, she turned to the bed and Tam. Master Alvear gave Rand a frustrated look.
"She's an Aes Sedai. Half the women in the village act as if she sits in the women's circle, and the rest as if she were a Trolloc. Not a one of them seems to realize you have to be careful around Aes Sedai. The men may keep looking at her sideways, but at least they aren't doing anything that might provoke her."
Careful, Rand thought. It was not too late to start being careful. "Master Alvear," he said slowly, "do you know how many farms were attacked?"
"Only two that I've heard of so far, including your place."
The mayor paused, frowning, then shrugged.
"It doesn't seem enough with what happened here. I should be glad of it, but... well, we'll probably hear of more before the day is out."
Rand sighed. No need to ask which farms.
"Here in the village, was there anything to show what they were after?"
"After, boy? I don't know that they were after anything, except maybe killing us all. It was just the way I said. The dogs barking, and Moraine Sedai and Lan running through the streets. Then somebody shouted that Master Luhan's house and the forge were on fire. Abu Cawthon's house flared up. Odd that, it's nearly in the middle of the village. Anyway, the next thing the Trollocs were all among us. No, I don't think they were after anything."
He gave an abrupt bark of a laugh and cut it short with a wary look at his wife. She did not look around from Tam.
"To tell the truth," he went on more quietly, "they seemed almost as confused as we were. I doubt they expected to find an Aes Sedai here, or a warder."
"I suppose not," Rand said, grimacing.
If Moraine had told the truth about that, she probably had told the truth about the rest, too. For a moment, he thought about asking the mayor's advice, but Master Alvear obviously knew little more about Aes Sedai than anyone else in the village. Besides, he was reluctant to tell even the mayor what was going on, what Moraine said was going on. He was not sure he was more afraid of being laughed at or being believed. He rubbed a thumb against the hilt of Tam's sword. His father had been out into the world. He must know more about Aes Sedai than the mayor did. But if Tam really had been out of the Two Rivers, then maybe what he had said in the Westwood...
He scrubbed both his hands through his hair, scattering that line of thought.
"You need sleep, lad," the mayor said.
"Yes, you do," Mistress Alvear added. "You're almost falling down where you stand." Rand blinked at her in surprise. He had not even realized she had left his father. He did need sleep. Just the thought set off a yawn.
"You can take the bed in the next room," the mayor said. "There's already a fire laid."
Rand looked at his father. Tam was still deep in sleep, and that made him yawn again. "I'd rather stay in here, if you don't mind, for when he wakes up." Sickroom matters were in Mistress Alvear's province, and the mayor left it to her. She hesitated only a moment before nodding. "But you let him wake on his own. If you bother his sleep..." He tried to say he would do as she ordered, but the words got tangled in yet another yawn. She shook her head with a smile. "You will be asleep yourself in no time at all. If you must stay, curl up next to the fire, and drink a little of that beef broth before you doze off."
"I will," Rand said.
He would have agreed to anything that kept him in that room.
"And I won't wake him."
"See that you do not," Mistress Alvear told him firmly, but not in an unkindly way. "I'll bring you up a pillow and some blankets." When the door finally closed behind them, Rand dragged the lone chair in the room over beside the bed and sat down where he could watch Tam. It was all very well for Mistress Alvear to talk about sleep. His jaws cracked as he stifled a yawn. But he could not sleep yet. Tam might wake at any time, and maybe only stay awake a short while. Rand had to be waiting when he did. He grimaced and twisted in the chair, absently shifting the sword hilt out of his ribs. He still felt awkward about telling anyone what Moraine had said. But this was Tam, after all. This was... Without realizing it, he set his jaw determinedly.
"My father. I can tell my father anything."
He twisted a little more in the chair and put his head against the chair back. Tam was his father, and nobody could tell him what to say or not say to his father. He just had to stay awake until Tam woke up. He just had to... Chapter 9 Tellings of the Wheel. Rand's heart pounded as he ran, and he stared in dismay at the barren hills surrounding him. This was not just a place where spring was late in coming. Spring had never come here, and never would come. Nothing grew in the cold soil that crunched under his boots, not so much as a bit of lichen. He scrambled past boulders twice as tall as he was. Dust coated the stone, as if never a drop of rain had touched it. The sun was a swollen, blood-red ball, more fiery than on the hottest day of summer, and bright enough to sear his eyes. But it stood dark against a leaden cauldron of a sky where clouds of sharp black and silver roiled and boiled on every horizon. For all the swirling clouds, though, no breath of breeze stirred across the land, and despite the sullen sun, the air burned cold like the depths of winter. Rand looked over his shoulder often as he ran, but he could not see his pursuers. Only desolate hills and jagged black mountains, many topped by tall plumes of dark smoke rising to join the milling clouds. If he could not see his hunters, though, he could hear them, howling behind him, guttural voices shouting with the glee of the chase, howling with the joy of blood to come. Trollocs, coming closer, and his strength was almost gone. With desperate haste, he scrambled to the top of a knife-edged ridge, then dropped to his knees with a groan. Below him, a sheer rock wall fell away, a 1,000-foot cliff plummeting into a vast canyon. Steamy mists covered the canyon floor, their thick gray surface rolling in grim waves, rolling and breaking against the cliff beneath him, but more slowly than any ocean wave had ever moved. Patches of fog glowed red for an instant, as if great fires had suddenly flared beneath, then died. Thunder rumbled in the depths of the valley, and lightning crackled through the gray, sometimes striking up at the sky. It was not the valley itself that sapped his strength and filled the empty spaces left with helplessness. From the center of the furious vapors, a mountain thrust upward, a mountain taller than any he had ever seen in the mountains of mist, a mountain as black as the loss of all hope. That bleak stone spire, a dagger stabbing at the heavens, was the source of his desolation. He had never seen it before, but he knew it.
The memory of it flashed away like quicksilver when he tried to touch it, but the memory was there. He knew it was there. Unseen fingers touched him, pulled at his arms and legs, trying to draw him to the mountain. His body twitched, ready to obey. His arms and legs stiffened, as if he thought he could dig his fingers and toes into the stone. Ghostly strings entwined around his heart, pulling him, calling him to the Spire Mountain. Tears ran down his face, and he sagged to the ground. He felt his will draining away like water out of a holed bucket. Just a little longer, and he would go where he was called. He would obey, do as he was told. Abruptly, he discovered another emotion. Anger. Push him, pull him. He was not a sheep to be prodded into a pen. The anger squeezed itself into one hard knot, and he clung to it as he would have clung to a raft in a flood.
"Serve me,"
a voice whispered in the stillness of his mind, a familiar voice. If he listened hard enough, he was sure he would know it.
"Serve me."
He shook his head to try to get it out of his head.
"Serve me."
He shook his fist at the Black Mountain.
"The light consume you, Shaitan."
Abruptly, the smell of death lay thick around him. A figure loomed over him in a cloak the color of dried blood, a figure with a face. He did not want to see the face that looked down at him. He did not want to think of that face. It hurt to think of it, turned his mind to embers. A hand reached toward him. Not caring if he fell over the edge, he threw himself away. He had to get away, far away. He fell, flailing at the air, wanting to scream, finding no breath for screaming, no breath at all. Abruptly, he was no longer in the barren land, no longer falling. Winter brown grass flattened under his boots. It seemed like flowers. He almost laughed to see scattered trees and bushes, leafless as they were, dotting the gently rolling plain that now surrounded him. In the distance reared a single mountain, its peak broken and split, but this mountain brought no fear or despair. It was just a mountain, though oddly out of place there, with no other in sight. A broad river flowed by the mountain, and on an island in the middle of that river was a city such as might live in a gleeman's tale, a city surrounded by high walls, gleaming white and silver beneath the warm sun. With mingled relief and joy, he started for the walls, for the safety and serenity he somehow knew he would find behind them. As he came closer, he made out soaring towers, many joined by wondrous walkways that spanned the open air. High bridges arced from both banks of the river to the island city. Even at a distance, he could see lacy stonework on those spans, seemingly too delicate to withstand the swift waters that rushed beneath them. Beyond those bridges lay safety, sanctuary. Of a sudden, a chill ran along his bones. An icy clamminess settled on his skin, and the air around him turned fetid and dank. Without looking back, he ran from the pursuer whose freezing fingers brushed his back and tugged at his cloak, ran from the light-eating figure with the face that— he could not remember the face, except as terror. He did not want to remember the face. He ran, and the ground passed beneath his feet, rolling hills and flat plain. And he wanted to howl like a dog gone mad. The city was receding before him. The harder he ran, the further away drifted the white shining walls and haven. They grew smaller and smaller until only a pale speck remained on the horizon. The cold hand of his pursuer clutched at his collar. If those fingers touched him, he knew he would go mad, or worse, much worse. Even as that surety came to him, he tripped and fell.
"No!"
he screamed, and grunted as paving stones smacked the breath out of him. Wonderingly, he got to his feet. He stood on the approaches to one of the marvelous bridges he had seen rearing over the river. Smiling people walked by on either side of him, people dressed in so many colors they made him think of a field of wildflowers. Some of them spoke to him, but he could not understand, though the words sounded as if he should. But the faces were friendly, and the people gestured him onward, over the bridge with its intricate stonework, onward toward the shining, silver-streaked walls and the towers beyond, toward the safety he knew waited there. He joined the throng streaming across the bridge and into the city through massive gates set in tall, pristine walls. Within was a wonderland where the meanest structure seemed a palace.
It was as though the builders had been told to take stone and brick and tile and create beauty to take the breath of mortal man. There was no building, no monument that did not make him stare with goggling eyes. Music drifted down the streets, 100 different songs, but all blending with the clamor of the crowds to make one grand, joyous harmony. The scents of sweet perfumes and sharp spices, of wondrous foods and myriad flowers all floated in the air, as if every good smell in the world were gathered there. The street by which he entered the city, broad and paved with smooth gray stone, stretched straight before him toward the center of the city. At its end loomed a tower larger and taller than any other in the city, a tower as white as fresh-fallen snow. That tower was where safety lay, and the knowledge he sought. But the city was such as he had never dreamed of seeing. Surely it would not matter if he delayed just a short time in going to the tower. He turned aside onto a narrower street where jugglers strolled among hawkers of strange fruits. Ahead of him down the street was a snow-white tower, the same tower. In just a little while, he thought, and rounded another corner. At the far end of this street, too, lay the white tower. Stubbornly, he turned another corner, and another, and each time, the alabaster tower met his eyes. He spun to run away from it, and skidded to a halt. Before him, the white tower. He was afraid to look over his shoulder, afraid it would be there, too. The faces around him were still friendly, but shattered hope filled them now. Hope he had broken. Still the people gestured him forward, pleading gestures. Toward the tower. Their eyes shone with desperate need, and only he could fulfill it. Only he could save them. Very well, he thought. The tower was, after all, where he wanted to go. Even as he took his first step forward, disappointment faded from those about him, and smiles wreathed every face. They moved with him, and small children strewed his path with flower petals. He looked over his shoulder in confusion, wondering who the flowers were meant for, but behind him were only more smiling people, gesturing him on. They must be for me, he thought, and wondered why that suddenly did not seem strange at all. But wonderment lasted only a moment before melting away. All was as it should be. First one, then another of the people began to sing until every voice was lifted into a glorious anthem. He still could not understand the words, but a dozen interweaving harmonies shouted joy and salvation. Musicians capered through the onflowing crowd, adding flutes and harps and drums in a dozen sizes to the hymn, and all the songs he had heard before blended in without seam. Girls danced around him, laying garlands of sweet-smelling blossoms across his shoulders, twining them about his neck. They smiled at him, their delight growing with every step he took. He could not help but smile back. His feet itched to join in their dance, and even as he thought of it, he was dancing, his steps fitting in as if he had known it all from birth. He threw back his head and laughed. His feet were lighter than they had ever been, dancing with... He could not remember the name, but it did not seem important. "It is your destiny," a voice whispered in his head, and the whisper was a thread in the paean. Carrying him like a twig on the crest of a wave, the crowd flowed into a huge square in the middle of the city, and for the first time he saw that the white tower rose from a great palace of pale marble. Sculpted rather than built, curving walls and swelling domes and delicate spires fingering the sky. The whole of it made him gasp in awe. Broad stairs of pristine stone led up from the square, and at the foot of those stairs the people halted, but their song rose ever higher. The swelling voices buoyed his feet. "Your destiny," the voice whispered, insistent now, eager. He no longer danced, but neither did he stop. He mounted the stairs without hesitation. This was where he belonged. Scrollwork covered the massive doors at the top of the stairs, carvings so intricate and delicate that he could not imagine a knife blade fine enough to fit. The portals swung open, and he went in. They closed behind him with an echoing crash like thunder.
"We have been waiting for you," the Murdral hissed.
Rand sat bolt upright, gasping for breath and shivering, staring. Tam was still asleep on the bed. Slowly his breathing slowed.
Half-consumed logs blazed in the fireplace with a good bed of coals built up around the fire irons. Someone had been there to tend to it while he slept. A blanket lay at his feet, where it had fallen when he woke. The makeshift litter was gone, too, and his and Tam's cloaks had been hung by the door. He wiped cold sweat from his face with a hand that was none too steady, and wondered if naming the Dark One in a dream brought his attention the same way that naming him aloud did. Twilight darkened the window. The moon was well up, round and fat, and evening stars sparkled above the mountains of mist. He had slept the day away. He rubbed a sore spot on his side. Apparently he had slept with the sword hilt jabbing him in the ribs. Between that and an empty stomach and the night before, it was no wonder he had had nightmares. His belly rumbled, and he got up stiffly and made his way to the table where Mistress Alvear had left the tray. He twitched aside the white napkin. Despite the time he had slept, the beef broth was still warm, and so was the crusty bread. Mistress Alvear's hand was plain. The tray had been replaced. When she decided you needed a hot meal, she did not give up till it was inside you. He gulped down some broth, and it was all he could do to put some meat and cheese between two pieces of bread before stuffing it in his mouth. Taking big bites, he went back to the bed. Mistress Alvear had apparently seen to Tam as well. Tam had been undressed, his clothes now clean and neatly folded on the bedside table, and a blanket was drawn up under his chin. When Rand touched his father's forehead, Tam opened his eyes.
"There you are, boy. Marin said you were here, but I couldn't even sit up to see. She said you were too tired for her to wake, just so I could look at you. Even Bran can't get around her when she has her mind set."
Tam's voice was weak, but his gaze was clear and steady.
The Aes Sedai was right, Bran thought. With rest, he would be as good as ever.
"Can I get you something to eat? Mistress Alvear left a tray."
"She fed me already, if you can call it that.
Wouldn't let me have anything but broth. How can a man avoid bad dreams with nothing but broth in his—"
Tam fumbled a hand from under the cover and touched the sword at Rand's waist.
"Then it wasn't a dream. When Marin told me I was sick, I thought I had been— But you're all right. That is all that matters. What of the farm?"
Rand took a deep breath.
"The Trollocs killed the sheep. I think they took the cow, too. And the house needs a good cleaning."
He managed a weak smile.
"We were luckier than some. They burned half the village."
He told Tam everything that had happened, or at least most of it. Tam listened closely and asked sharp questions, so he found himself having to tell about returning to the farmhouse from the woods, and that brought in the Trolloc he had killed. He had to tell how Nynaeve had said Tam was dying to explain why the Aes Sedai attended him instead of the Wisdom. Tam's eyes widened at that, and Aes Sedai in Emmons Field. But Rand could see no need to go over every step of the journey from the farm, or his fears, or the Murdral on the road. Certainly not his nightmares as he slept by the bed. Especially he saw no reason to mention Tam's ramblings under the fever. Not yet. Moraine's story, though, there was no avoiding that.
"Now that's a tale to make a gleeman proud," Tam muttered when he was done. "What would Trollocs want with you boys? Or the Dark One might help us."
"You think she was lying? Master Alvear said she was telling the truth about only two farms being attacked, and about Master Luhan's house and Master Cawthon's."
For a moment, Tam lay silent before saying,
"Tell me what she said. Her exact words, mind. Just as she said them."
Rand struggled. Whoever remembered the exact words they heard? He chewed at his lip and scratched his head, and bit by bit he brought it out as nearly as he could remember.
"I can't think of anything else," he finished. "Some of it I'm not too sure she didn't say a little differently, but it's close anyway."
"It's good enough. It has to be, doesn't it? You see, lad, Aes Sedai are tricksome. They don't lie, not right out. But the truth an Aes Sedai tells you is not always the truth you think it is. You take care around her."
"I've heard the stories," Rand retorted. "I'm not a child."
"So you're not. So you're not," Tam sighed heavily.
then shrugged in annoyance.
I should be going along with you just the same. The world outside the Two Rivers is nothing like Emmons Field.
That was an opening to ask about Tam going outside and all the rest of it, but Tam did not take it. His mouth fell open instead.
Just like that? I thought you would try to talk me out of it. I thought you'd have 100 reasons I should not go.
He realized he had been hoping Tam would have 100 reasons, and good ones.
Maybe not 100, Tam said with a snort. But a few did come to mind. Only they don't count for much. If Trollocs are after you, you will be safer in Tar Valon than you could ever be here. Just remember to be wary. Aes Sedai do things for their own reasons, and those are not always the reasons you think.
The Gleeman said something like that, Rand said slowly.
Then he knows what he's talking about. You listen sharp, think deep, and guard your tongue. That's good advice for any dealings beyond the Two Rivers, but most especially with Aes Sedai. And with warders. Tell Lan something, and you've as good as told Moraine. If he's a warder, then he's bonded to her as sure as the sun rose this morning. And he won't keep many secrets from her, if any.
Rand knew little about the bonding between Aes Sedai and warders, though it played a big part in every story about warders he had ever heard. It was something to do with the power, a gift to the warder, or maybe some sort of exchange. The warders got all sorts of benefits, according to the stories. They healed more quickly than other men, and could go longer without food or water or sleep. Supposedly, they could sense Trollocs if they were close enough, and other creatures of the Dark One, too, which explained how Lan and Moraine had tried to warn the village before the attack. As to what the Aes Sedai got out of it, the stories were silent. But he was not about to believe they did not get something.
"I'll be careful," Rand said. "I just wish I knew why. It doesn't make any sense. Why me? Why us?"
"I wish I knew too, boy. Blood and ashes, I wish I knew."
Tam sighed heavily.
"Well, no use trying to put a broken egg back in the shell, I suppose. How soon do you have to go? I'll be back on my feet in a day or two, and we can see about starting a new flock. Orin Daughtry has some good stock he might be willing to part with the pastures all gone. And so does John Thane."
"Moraine, the Aes Sedai said you had to stay in bed. She said weeks."
Tam opened his mouth, but Rand went on.
"And she talked to Mistress Alvear."
"Oh, well, maybe I can talk Marin around."
Tam did not sound hopeful of it, though. He gave Rand a sharp look.
"The way you avoided answering means you have to leave soon. Tomorrow? Or tonight?"
"Tonight,"
Rand said quietly, and Tam nodded sadly.
"Yes. Well, if it must be done, best not to delay. But we will see about this week's business."
He plucked at his blankets with more irritation than strength.
"Perhaps I'll follow in a few days anyway. Catch you up on the road. We'll see if Marn can keep me in bed when I want to get up."
There was a tap at the door, and Lan stuck his head into the room.
"Say your goodbyes quickly, sheepherder, and come. There may be trouble."
"Trouble?"
Rand said, and the warder growled at him impatiently.
"Just hurry."
Hastily, Rand snatched up his cloak. He started to undo the sword belt, but Tam spoke up.
"Keep it. You will probably have more need of it than I, though the light willing, neither of us will. Take care, lad. You hear?"
Ignoring Lan's continued growls, Rand bent to grab Tam in a hug.
"I will come back. I promise you that."
"Of course you will,"
Tam laughed. He returned the hug weakly, and ended by patting Rand on the back.
"I know that. And I'll have twice as many sheep for you to tend when you return. Now go, before that fellow does himself an injury."
Rand tried to hang back, tried to find the words for the question he did not want to ask, but Lan entered the room to catch him by the arm and pull him into the hall. The warder had donned a dull gray-green tunic of overlapping metal scales. His voice rasped with irritation.
"We have to hurry. Don't you understand the word trouble?"
Outside the room, Matt waited, cloaked and coated, and carrying his bow.
A quiver hung at his waist. He was rocking anxiously on his heels, and he kept glancing off toward the stairs with what seemed to be equal parts impatience and fear.
"This isn't much like the stories, Rand, is it?"
he said hoarsely.
"What kind of trouble?"
Rand demanded, but the warder ran ahead of him instead of answering, taking the steps down two at a time. Matt dashed after him with quick gestures for Rand to follow. Shrugging into his cloak, he caught up to them downstairs. Only a feeble light filled the common room. Half the candles had burned out, and most of the rest were guttering. It was empty except for the three of them. Matt stood next to one of the front windows, peeping out as if trying not to be seen. Lan held the door open a crack and peered into the inn yard. Wondering what they could be watching, Rand went to join him. The warder muttered at him to take a care, but he did open the door a trifle wider to make room for Rand to look too. At first he was not sure exactly what he was seeing. A crowd of village men, some 3 dozen or so, clustered near the burned-out husk of the peddler's wagon, night pushed back by the torches some of them carried. Moraine faced them, her back to the inn, leaning with seeming casualness on her walking staff. Harry Coplin stood in the front of the group with his brother Darl and Billy Conger. Sen Bowie was there as well, looking uncomfortable. Rand was startled to see Harry shake his fist at Moraine.
"Leave Emmonsfield!"
the sour-faced farmer shouted. A few voices in the crowd echoed him, but hesitantly, and no one pushed forward. They might be willing to confront an Aes Sedai from within a crowd, but none of them wanted to be singled out. Not by an Aes Sedai who had every reason to take offense.
"You brought those monsters!" Darl roared.
He waved a torch over his head, and there were shouts of,
"You brought them, and it's your fault!"
led by his cousin Billy. Harry elbowed Sen Bowie, and the old thatcher pursed his lips and gave him a sidelong glare.
"Those things, those Trollocs, didn't appear until after you came," Sen muttered, barely loud enough to be heard.
He swung his head from side to side dourly, as if wishing he were somewhere else, and looking for a way to get there.
"You're an Aes Sedai. We want none of your sort in the Two Rivers. Aes Sedai bring trouble on their backs. If you stay, you will only bring more."
His speech brought no response from the gathered villagers, and Harry scowled in frustration. Abruptly, he snatched Darl's torch and shook it in her direction.
"Get out!" he shouted. "Or we'll burn you out!"
Dead silence fell, except for the shuffling of a few feet as men drew back. Two Rivers folk could fight back if they were attacked, but violence was far from common, and threatening people was foreign to them, beyond the occasional shaking of a fist. Sen Bowie, Billy Conger, and the Coplins were left out front alone. Billy looked as if he wanted to back away, too. Harry gave an uneasy start at the lack of support, but he recovered quickly.
"Get out!"
he shouted again, echoed by Darl, and more weakly by Billy. Harry glared at the others. Most of the crowd failed to meet his eye. Suddenly, Bran Alvir and Harald Luhan moved out of the shadows, stopping apart from both the Aes Sedai and the crowd. In one hand, the mayor casually carried the big wooden maul he used to drive spigots into casks.
"Did someone suggest burning my inn?" he asked softly.
The two Coplins took a step back, and Sen Bowie edged away from them. Billy Conger dived into the crowd.
"Not that," Darl said quickly. "We never said that, Bran. Mayor."
Bran nodded.
"Then perhaps I heard you threatening to harm guests in my inn?"
"She's an Aes Sedai,"
Harry began angrily, but his words cut off as Harald Luhan moved. The blacksmith simply stretched, thrusting thick arms over his head, tightening massive fists until his knuckles cracked, but Harry looked at the burly man as if one of those fists had been shaken under his nose. Harald folded his arms across his chest.
"Your pardon, Harry. I did not mean to cut you off. You were saying..."
But Harry, shoulders hunched as though he were trying to draw into himself and disappear, seemed to have nothing more to say.
"I'm surprised at you people," Bran rumbled.
"Petal Kar, your boy's leg was broken last night, but I saw him walking on it today, because of her. Ewad Kandin, you were lying on your belly with a gash down your back like a fish for cleaning, till she laid hands on you. Now it looks as if it happened a month ago. And unless I misdoubt, there'll be barely a scar. And you, Sen,
The Thatcher started to fade back into the crowd, but stopped, held uncomfortably by Bran's gaze.
"I'd be shocked to see any man on the village council here, Sen. But you, most of all. Your arm would still be hanging useless at your side, a mass of burns and bruises, if not for her. If you have no gratitude, have you no shame?"
Sen half lifted his right hand, then looked away from it angrily.
"I cannot deny what she did," he muttered,
and he did sound ashamed.
"She helped me and others,"
he went on in a pleading tone.
"But she's an Aes Sedai, Bran. If those Trollocs didn't come because of her, why did they come? We want no part of Aes Sedai in the Two Rivers. Let them keep their troubles away from us."
A few men, safely back in the crowd, shouted then.
"We want no Aes Sedai troubles. Send her away. Drive her out. Why did they come if not because of her?"
A scowl grew on Bran's face, but before he could speak, Moiraine suddenly whirled her vine-carved staff above her head, spinning it with both hands. Bran's gasp echoed that of the villagers, for a hissing white flame flared from each end of the staff, standing straight out like spear points despite the rod's whirling. Even Bran and Harl edged away from her. She snapped her arms down straight out before her, the staff parallel to the ground, but the pale fire still jetted out, brighter than the torches. Men shied away, held up hands to shield their eyes from the pain of that brilliance.
"Is this what Aemon's blood has come to?"
The Aes Sedai's voice was not loud, but it overwhelmed every other sound.
"Little people squabbling for the right to hide like rabbits? You have forgotten who you were, forgotten what you were. But I had hoped some small part was left, some memory in blood and bone, some shred to steel you for the long night coming."
No one spoke. The two Coplins looked as if they had never wanted to open their mouths again.
Bran said, "Forgotten who we were. We are who we always have been. Honest farmers and shepherds and craftsmen. Two Rivers folk." "To the south," Moiraine said, "lies the river you call the White River. But far to the east of here, men call it still by its rightful name, Mon Etherendrel. In the old tongue, waters of the mountain home. Sparkling waters that once coursed through a land of bravery and beauty. 2,000 years ago, Mon Etherendrel flowed by the walls of a mountain city, so lovely to behold that Ogier stonemasons came to stare in wonder. Farms and villages covered this region, and that you call the Forest of Shadows as well, and beyond. But all of those folk thought of themselves as the people of the mountain home, the people of Mon Etheren. Their king was Aemon Al-Kar Al-Thoren, Aemon, son of Kar, son of Thoren, and Eldraine, I Elan, I Carlan, was his queen. Aemon, a man so fearless that the greatest compliment for courage any could give, even among his enemies, was to say a man had Aemon's heart. Eldraine, so beautiful that it was said the flowers bloomed to make her smile. Bravery and beauty and wisdom, and a love that death could not sunder. Weep, if you have a heart, for the loss of them, for the loss of even their memory. Weep for the loss of their blood."
She fell silent then, but no one spoke. Rand was as bound as the others in the spell she had created. When she spoke again, he drank it in, and so did the rest.
"For nearly 2 centuries, the Trolloc Wars had ravaged the length and breadth of the world, and wherever battles raged, the Red Eagle banner of Mon Etheren was in the forefront. The men of Mon Etheren were a thorn to the Dark One's foot and a bramble to his hand. Sing of Mon Etheren that would never bend knee to the shadow. Sing of Mon Etheren, the sword that could not be broken. They were far away, the men of Mon Etheren, on the field of Bekkar, called the Field of Blood, when news came that a Trolloc army was moving against their home. Too far to do else but wait to hear of their land's death, for the forces of the Dark One meant to make an end of them, kill the mighty oak by hacking away its roots. Too far to do else but mourn. But they were the men of the mountain home. Without hesitation, without thought for the distance they must travel, they marched from the very field of victory, still covered in dust and sweat and blood. Day and night they marched, for they had seen the horror a Trolloc army left behind it,
and no man of them could sleep while such a danger threatened Manetharan. They moved as if their feet had wings, marching further and faster than friends hoped or enemies feared they could. At any other day, that march alone would have inspired songs. When the Dark One's armies swooped down upon the lands of Manetharan, the men of the mountain home stood before it with their backs to the Tarandrel. Some villager raised a small cheer then, but Moraine kept on as if she had not heard. The host that faced the men of Manetharan was enough to daunt the bravest heart. Ravens blackened the sky. Trollocs blackened the land. Trollocs and their human allies. Trollocs and dark friends in tens of thousands, and dread lords to command. At night their cookfires outnumbered the stars, and dawn revealed the banner of Baal-Zamon at their head. Baal-Zamon, heart of the dark. An ancient name for the father of lies. The Dark One could not have been free of his prison at Sheol-Ghul, for if he had been, not all the forces of humankind together could have stood against him. But there was power there. Dread lords, and some evil that made that light-destroying banner seem no more than right, and sent a chill into the souls of men who faced it. Yet they knew what they must do. Their homeland lay just across the river. They must keep that host and the power with it from the mountain home. Aemon had sent out messengers. Aid was promised if they could hold for but 3 days at the Tarandrel. Hold for 3 days against odds that should overwhelm them in the first hour. Yet somehow, through bloody assault and desperate defense, they held through an hour, and the second hour, and the third. For 3 days they fought, and though the land became a butcher's yard, no crossing of the Tarandrel did they yield. By the third night, no help had come, and no messengers, and they fought on alone. For 6 days, for 9, and on the 10th day, Aemon knew the bitter taste of betrayal. No help was coming, and they could hold the river crossings no more.
"Where do they go?"
Hari demanded. Torch fires flickered in the chill night breeze, but no one made a move to draw a cloak tighter.
"Aemon crossed the Tarandrel," Moraine told them, "destroying the bridges behind him. And he sent word throughout his land for the people to flee, for he knew the powers with the Trolloc Horde would find a way to bring it across the river. Even as the word went out, the Trolloc crossing began, and the soldiers of Manetharan took up the fight again, to buy with their lives what hours they could for their people to escape. From the city of Manetharan, Eldraine organized the flight of her people into the deepest forests and the fastness of the mountains. But some did not flee. First in a trickle, then in a river, then a flood, men went not to safety, but to join the army fighting for their land. Shepherds with bows and farmers with pitchforks, and woodsmen with axes. Women went too, shouldering what weapons they could find and marching side by side with their men. No one made that journey who did not know they would never return. But it was their land. It had been their father's, and it would be their children's. And they went to pay the price of it. Not a step of ground was given up until it was soaked in blood. But at the last, the army of Manetharan was driven back. Back to here. To this place you now call Emmons Field. And here the Trolloc hordes surrounded them."
Her voice held the sound of cold tears.
"Trolloc dead and the corpses of human renegades piled up in mounds, but always more scrambled over those charnel heaps and waves of death that had no end. There could be but one finish. No man or woman who had stood beneath the banner of the Red Eagle at that day's dawning still lived when night fell. The sword that could not be broken was shattered. In the mountains of mist, alone in the emptied city of Manetharan, Eldraine felt Aemon die, and her heart died with him. And where her heart had been was left only a thirst for vengeance. Vengeance for her love. Vengeance for her people and her land. Driven by grief, she reached out to the true source and hurled the one power at the Trolloc army. And there the dreadlords died wherever they stood, whether in their secret councils or exhorting their soldiers. In the passing of a breath, the Dreadlords and the generals of the Dark One's host burst into flame. Fire consumed their bodies, and terror consumed their just victorious army. Now they ran like beasts before a wildfire in the forest, with no thought for anything but escape. North and south they fled. Thousands drowned attempting to cross the Tarandrel without the aid of the Dreadlords. And at the Monethandrel, they tore down the bridges in their fright at what might be following them. Where they found people, they slew and burned. But to flee was the need that gripped them. Until at last, no one of them remained in the lands of Monetharin. They were dispersed like dust before the whirlwind. The final vengeance came more slowly, but it came. When they were hunted down by other peoples, by other armies in other lands, none was left alive of those who did murder at Aemon's Field. But the price was high for Monetharin. Eldraine had drawn to herself more of the one power than any human could ever hope to wield unaided. As the enemy generals died, so did she die. And the fires that consumed her consumed the empty city of Monetharin. Even the stones of it, down to the living rock of the mountains. Yet the people had been saved. Nothing was left of their farms, their villages, or their great city. Some would say there was nothing left for them, nothing but to flee to other lands, where they could begin anew. They did not say so. They had paid such a price in blood and hope for their land as had never been paid before, and now they were bound to that soil by ties stronger than steel. Other wars would rack them in years to come, until at last their corner of the world was forgotten. And at last, they had forgotten wars and the ways of war. Never again did Monetharin rise. Its soaring spires and splashing fountains became as a dream that slowly faded from the minds of its people. But they and their children's children, held the land that was theirs. They held it when the long centuries had washed the why of it from their memories. They held it until today. There is you. Weep for Monetharin. Weep for what is lost forever. The fires and Moraine's staff winked out, and she lowered it to her side as if it weighed 100 pounds. For a long moment, the moan of the wind was the only sound. Then Pate Alkar shouldered past the Coplins.
"I don't know about your story," the long-jawed farmer said. "I'm no thorn to the Dark One's foot, nor ever likely to be, neither. But my will is walking because of you, and for that I am ashamed to be here. I don't know if you can forgive me, but whether you will or no, I'll be going. And for me, you can stay in Aemon's Field as long as you like."
With a quick duck of his head, almost a bow, he pushed back through the crowd. Others began to mutter then, offering shamefaced penitence before they, too, slipped away one by one. The Coplins, sour-mouthed and scowling once more, looked at the faces around them and vanished into the night without a word. Billy Conger had disappeared even before his cousins. Land pulled Rand back and shut the door.
"Let's go, boy."
The warder started for the back of the inn.
"Come along, both of you, quickly."
Rand hesitated, exchanging a wondering glance with Matt. While Moraine had been telling the story, Master Alvir's Durans could not have dragged him away, but now something else held his feet. This was the real beginning, leaving the inn and following the warder into the night. He shook himself and tried to firm his resolve. He had no choice but to go, but he would come back to Aemon's Field, however far or long this journey was.
"What are you waiting for?"
Lan asked from the door that led out of the back of the common room. With a start, Matt hurried to him. Trying to convince himself that he was beginning a grand adventure, Rand followed them through the darkened kitchen and out into the stable yard. Chapter 10. Leave-Taking. A single lantern, its shutters half-closed, hung from a nail on a stall post, casting a dim light. Deep shadows swallowed most of the stalls. As Rand came through the doors from the stable-yard, hard on the heels of Matt and the warder, Perrin leaped up in a rustle of straw from where he had been sitting with his back against a stall door.
A heavy cloak swathed him.
Land barely paused to demand, "Did you look the way I told you, blacksmith?"
"I looked," Perrin replied. "There's nobody here but us. Why would anybody hide?"
"Care and a long life go together, blacksmith."
The warder ran a quick eye around the shadowed stable and the deeper shadows of the hayloft above, then shook his head.
"No time," he muttered half to himself. "Hurry," she says.
As if to suit his words, he strode quickly to where the five horses stood tethered, bridled, and saddled at the back of the pool of light. Two were the black stallion and white mare that Rand had seen before. The others, if not quite so tall or so sleek, certainly appeared to be among the best the Two Rivers had to offer. With hasty care, Land began examining cinches and girth straps, and the leather ties that held saddlebags, water skins, and blanket rolls behind the saddles. Rand exchanged shaky smiles with his friends, trying hard to look as if he really was eager to be off. For the first time, Matt noticed the sword at Rand's waist and pointed to it.
"You becoming a warder?"
He laughed, then swallowed it with a quick glance at Lan. The warder apparently took no notice.
"Or at least a merchant's guard," Matt went on with a grin that seemed only a little forced.
He hefted his bow.
"An honest man's weapon isn't good enough for him."
Rand thought about flourishing the sword, but Lan being there stopped him. The warder was not even looking in his direction, but he was sure the man was aware of everything that went on around him. Instead, he said with exaggerated casualness,
"It might be useful,"
as if wearing a sword were nothing out of the ordinary. Perrin moved, trying to hide something under his cloak. Rand glimpsed a wide leather belt encircling the apprentice blacksmith's waist, with the handle of an axe thrust through a loop on the belt.
"What do you have there?"
he asked.
"Merchant's guard, indeed," Matt hooted.
The shaggy-haired youth gave Matt a frown that suggested he had already had more than his share of joking, then sighed heavily and tossed back his cloak to uncover the axe. It was no common woodsman's tool. A broad half-moon blade on one side of the head and a curved spike on the other made it every bit as strange for the Two Rivers as Rand's sword. Perrin's hand rested on it with a sense of familiarity, though.
"Master Luhan made it about 2 years ago for a woodbuyer's guard. But when it was done, the fellow wouldn't pay what he had agreed, and Master Luhan would not take less. He gave it to me when—"
He cleared his throat, then shot Rand the same warning frown he'd given Matt.
"When he found me practicing with it. He said I might as well have it, since he couldn't make anything useful from it."
"Practicing," Matt snickered, but held up his hands soothingly when Perrin raised his head.
"As you say, it's just as well one of us knows how to use a real weapon."
"That bow is a real weapon," Land said suddenly.
He propped an arm across the saddle of his tall black and regarded them gravely.
"So are the slings I've seen you village boys with. Just because you never use them for anything but hunting rabbits or chasing a wolf away from the sheep makes no difference. Anything can be a weapon if the man or woman who holds it has the nerve and will make it so. Trollocs aside, you had better have that clear in your minds before we leave the Two Rivers, before we leave Emmons Field, if you want to reach Tar Valon alive."
His face and voice, cold as death and hard as a rough-hewn gravestone, stifled their smiles and their tongues. Perrin grimaced and pulled his cloak back over the axe. Matt stared at his feet and stirred the straw on the stable floor with his toe. The warder grunted and went back to his checking, and the silence lengthened.
"It isn't much like the stories," Matt said finally.
"I don't know," Perrin said sourly. "Trollocs, a warder, an Aes Sedai. What more could you ask?"
"Aes Sedai,"
Matt whispered, sounding as if he were suddenly cold.
"Do you believe her, Rand?" Perrin asked. "I mean, what would Trollocs want with us?"
As one, they glanced at the warder. Lan appeared absorbed in the white mare's saddle girth, but the three of them moved back toward the stable door, away from Lan. Even so, they huddled together and spoke softly. Rand shook his head.
"I don't know. But she had it right about our farms being the only ones attacked. And they attacked Master Luhan's house and the forge first, here in the village. I asked the mayor. It's as easy to believe they are after us as anything else I can think of."
Suddenly he realized they were both staring at him.
"You asked the mayor?"
Matt said incredulously.
"She said not to tell anybody." "I didn't tell him why I was asking,"
Rand protested.
"Do you mean you didn't talk to anybody at all? You didn't let anybody know you were going?"
Perrin shrugged defensively.
Moraine Sedai said not anybody.
We left notes, Matt said, for our families. They'll find them in the morning. Matt, my mother thinks Tar Valon is the next thing to Sheol Ghul.
He gave a little laugh to show he did not share her opinion. It was not very convincing.
She'd try to lock me in the cellar if she believed I was even thinking of going there.
Master Luhan is stubborn as a stone, Perrin added, and Mistress Luhan is worse. If you'd seen her digging through what's left of the house, saying she hoped the Trollocs did come back so she could get her hands on them.
Burn me, Rand, Matt said. I know she's an Aes Sedai and all, but the Trollocs were really here. She said not to tell anybody. If an Aes Sedai doesn't know what to do about something like this, who does?
I don't know. Rand rubbed at his forehead. His head hurt. He could not get that dream out of his mind. My father believes her. At least he agreed that we had to go. Suddenly Moraine was in the doorway.
You talked to your father about this journey?
She was clothed in dark gray from head to foot, with a skirt divided for riding astride, and the serpent ring was the only gold she wore now. Rand eyed her walking staff. Despite the flames he had seen, there was no sign of charring, or even soot.
I couldn't go off without letting him know.
She eyed him for a moment, with pursed lips, before turning to the others.
And did you also decide that a note was not enough?
Matt and Perrin talked on top of each other, assuring her they had only left notes, the way she had said. Nodding, she waved them to silence and gave Rand a sharp look.
What is done is already woven in the pattern. Lan?
The horses are ready, the warder said, and we have enough provisions to reach Beirlan with some despair. We can leave at any time. I suggest now.
Not without me.
Egwene slipped into the stable, a shawl-wrapped bundle in her arms. Rand nearly fell over his own feet. Lan's sword had come half out of its sheath. When he saw who it was, he shoved the blade back, his eyes suddenly flat. Perrin and Matt began babbling to convince Moraine they had not told Egwene about leaving. The Aes Sedai ignored them. She simply looked at Egwene, tapping her lips thoughtfully with one finger. The hood of Egwene's dark brown cloak was pulled up, but not enough to hide the defiant way she faced Moraine.
I have everything I need here, including food, and I will not be left behind. I'll probably never get another chance to see the world outside the Two Rivers. This isn't a picnic trip into the Waterwood, Egwene, Matt growled.
He stepped back when she looked at him from under lowered brows.
Thank you, Matt. I wouldn't have known. Do you think you three are the only ones who want to see what's outside? I've dreamed about it as long as you have, and I don't intend to miss this chance.
How did you find out we were leaving? Rand demanded.
Anyway, you can't go with us. We aren't leaving for the fun of it. The Trollocs are after us.
She gave him a tolerant look, and he flushed and stiffened indignantly.
First, she told him patiently, I saw Matt creeping about, trying hard not to be noticed. Then I saw Perrin attempting to hide that absurd great axe under his cloak. I knew Lan had bought a horse, and it suddenly occurred to me to wonder why he needed another. And if he could buy one, he could buy others. Putting that with Matt and Perrin sneaking about like bull calves pretending to be foxes, well, I could only see one answer. I don't know if I'm surprised or not to find you here, Rand, after all your talk about daydreams. With Matt and Perrin involved, I suppose I should have known you would be in it, too.
I have to go, Egwene, Rand said. All of us do, or the Trollocs will come back.
The Trollocs?
Egwene laughed incredulously.
Rand, if you've decided to see some of the world, well and good, but please spare me any of your nonsensical tales.
It's true, Perrin said, as Matt began.
The Trollocs!
Enough, Moraine said quietly, but it cut their talk as sharply as a knife. Did anyone else notice all of this? Her voice was soft, but Egwene swallowed and drew herself up before answering.
After last night, all they can think about is rebuilding. That and what to do if it happens again. They couldn't see anything else unless it was pushed under their noses. And I told no one what I suspected. No one.
Very well, Moraine said after a moment. You may come with us. A startled expression darted across Lan's face. It was gone in an instant, leaving him outwardly calm, but furious words erupted from him.
No, Moraine!
It is part of the pattern now, Lan.
It is ridiculous, he retorted. There's no reason for her to come along, and every reason for her not to.
There is a reason for it, Moraine said calmly. A part of the pattern, Lan.
The warder's stony face showed nothing, but he nodded slowly.
"But Egwene," Rand said, "the Trollocs will be chasing us. We won't be safe until we get to Tar Valon."
"Don't try to frighten me off," she said. "I am going." Rand knew that tone of voice. He had heard it since she decided that climbing the tallest trees was for children. But he remembered it well.
"If you think being chased by Trollocs will be fun," he began.
But Moraine interrupted.
"We have no time for this. We must be as far away as possible by daybreak. If she is left behind, Rand, she could rouse the village before we have gone a mile, and that would surely warn the Murdral."
"I would not do that," Egwene protested.
"She can ride the Gleeman's horse," the warder said. "I'll leave him enough to buy another."
"That will not be possible," came Tom Marilyn's resonant voice from the hayloft.
Lan's sword left its sheath this time, and he did not put it back as he stared up at the Gleeman. Tom tossed down a blanket roll, then slung his cased flute and harp across his back and shouldered bulging saddlebags.
"This village has no use for me now, while on the other hand, I have never performed in Tar Valon. And though I usually journey alone, after last night, I have no objections at all to traveling in company."
The warder gave Perrin a hard look, and Perrin shifted uncomfortably. "I didn't think of looking in the loft," he muttered.
As the long-limbed Gleeman scrambled down the ladder from the loft, Lan spoke, stiffly formal.
"Is this part of the pattern, too?" Moraine said I.
"Everything is a part of the pattern, my old friend," Moraine replied softly. "We cannot pick and choose, but we shall see."
Tom put his feet on the stable floor and turned from the ladder, brushing straw from his patch-covered cloak.
"In fact," he said in more normal tones, "you might say that I insist on traveling in company. I have given many hours over many mugs of ale to thinking of how I might end my days. A Trolloc's cookpot was not one of the thoughts."
He looked askance at the warder's sword.
"There's no need for that. I am not a cheese for slicing."
"Master Merlin," Moraine said, "we must go quickly and almost certainly in great danger. The Trollocs are still out there, and we go by night. Are you sure that you want to travel with us?"
Tom eyed the lot of them with a quizzical smile.
"If it is not too dangerous for the girl, it can't be too dangerous for me. Besides, what Gleeman would not face a little danger to perform in Tar Valon?"
Moraine nodded, and Lan scabbarded his sword. Rand suddenly wondered what would have happened if Tom had changed